This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Daniel Storrs. Today is September 8, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Storrs is joining me by phone from Collierville, Tennessee. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. If we could begin, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, on June 20th, 1947.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names, and what did they do for a living?
My mom and dad's name, Daniel Martin Storrs, Jr., I'm sorry, Sr.,
mm-hmm.
And my mom was Maddie Davis. And my mom was a house worker that later worked for Sears Roebuck.
Okay.
And my father was an upholsterer.
All right. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about growing up in Memphis? Did you grow up in Memphis?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
The first 18 years before I joined the Marine Corps, my dad was an alcoholic. My mom basically stayed home with me, a younger brother, 7 years younger, a younger sister, a year and a half younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I played sports and was pretty much a loner, just with a few friends, and as I grew into sports and everything, I was pretty lucky to be able to be a pretty good athlete, and got to be about 17, and like a lot of young boys, was ready to get out of home and go prove myself to be a man, and didn't have money for college, so I always wanted to be a Marine, so I joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. All right. did you have any interest in the Marines as a kid growing up, or was that something that developed as you got closer to the age to join?
No, actually, watching some of the old war movies and just the Marine Corps him, and all my dad and his brothers were all in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't care a whole lot about water at the time. I didn't want to join the Navy. And anyway, a couple of my friends had talked about joining Marines out of high school, so three of us joined and went together.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wanted to be in the Marines, and that was the only choice I'd even thought about.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right. You mentioned the movies being influenced. Do you remember any of the specific movies?
Yeah. There was one with Randolph Scott called Gung Ho.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. There was, a couple of the John Wayne movies. Can't think of their names right off the bat. But,
sure.
Sam's an Iwo Jima and a few of those.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, they always kind of got my attention, especially the Marine Corps song, him, when it went off. So
mm-hmm.
You just feel like standing and going and getting somebody. So.
Right, sure. Now, your dad and your uncles that you said were in the military, had they served in World War II?
Yeah, four of them out of the five served in World War II, and all of them were in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
One uncle was on the Lexington when it was sunk.
Mm.
My dad was on the LST, and they came close on occasion, especially down in Sicily, when two torpedoes were heading toward their ship, and a destroyer cut in and took both torpedoes and killed every man on the destroyer.
Mm. Wow.
Dad had a lot of memories, and back then, growing up as a kid, you either played Army or you played Cowboys, so
mm-hmm.
that's the way it was back in those days.
Right.
So you had all kind of surplus World War II and Korean stuff, so most of us kids had helmets and cartridge belts and pretend rifles and stuff, so
mm-hmm.
back then it was fun to go out and dig a hole in the yard. So.
Right. All right. Well, before we get to whenever you joined the Marines, talk a little bit about school and about sports. First of all, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Oak Haven High School.
Okay.
The new county school at the time.
All right. and you mentioned that you played sport. What sports did you play?
At that time, I played baseball and football.
Okay.
And then later I started in basketball. Mm-hmm. But baseball and football mainly was a kid.
Sure. All right. And when did you graduate from high school?
May of 1965.
Okay. All right. And during this time when you were growing up, did you pay close attention to what was going on in the world with the Cold War and everything going on?
Not really.
Okay. All right. So how soon after high school did you decide to join the Marines?
Well, actually, I did the early thing. I joined, like, I believe it was in March or April of 65, what they called an early up.
Okay.
Where you could actually join the Marine Corps and you didn't have to report till you were out of high school, but the time counted for your enlistment.
Okay. All right. And did you have to, were there things that you would have to do on the weekend, or was there no real commitment?
No, there was no real commitment. They just were trying to get a hold of anybody they could, and this early program they had was just designed to get the people joined that were still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Just to have them a couple months count on their time before they, you know, they, I think the only specifications is right after high school you had like 30 days or something that, you know, you had to report in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was about the only specs I can remember.
Right. All right. Okay. And were there, while in high school, were there the recruiters coming to the school and things like that? Or?
Yeah. I remember them coming in the junior year,
mm-hmm.
and I believe at that time they came the same day as when some of the college recruiters came in.
Okay.
I'm not even sure if they're allowed to do that anymore, but I mm-hmm. remember that they did back in those days.
Right. All right. You mentioned you and some of your friends decided to join up about the same time. Were there several students from your class that joined the Marines, or was it just a small group like you and your friends?
Well, it's always a small group.
Right, sure. Sure.
Not many people want to join the Marines.
Uh-huh.
Like now standing up in church on you know, the particular holidays, you got all the Army and Air Force guys stand up. And,
mm-hmm.
There's just a couple guys who ever stand up from the Marine Corps.
Right.
But, there were three of us that joined,
mm-hmm.
and one of them passed away quite a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
But we all three made it through Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. what did your family think about your decision to join?
Well, my mom was worried, and my dad, you know, he didn't really care. He thought it was something good for me to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was about, you know, the extent of it.
All right. Okay. So let's see. You said about 30 days after graduation you were to report?
Well, I actually reported 3 days after graduation.
Okay.
So I had 3 days from school, and I reported, I believe, like around the 1st of June, the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd of June,
mm-hmm.
to Parris Island.
Okay. All right. how long was the training at Parris Island?
I think it was 11 weeks back then.
Okay.
It was whatever the original was before they started cutting it back.
Right. Okay.
Then you went to Camp Geiger, or I think it was 4 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever it was, and
mm-hmm.
then you reported home for some time off and then to your first duty station.
All right. All right. Could you talk a little bit about boot camp, a little bit about the training and kind of your daily routine there?
I can talk about it now. You sure couldn't talk about it then.
Right.
Back in those days, it was the first time I'd ever rode an airplane.
Okay.
And I took a flight from Memphis, and I believe it was to Raleigh or somewhere like that. I can't remember exactly. It was
mm-hmm.
one of the other big cities. And then they had a bus waiting for us. And some guys from the Marine Corps met us at the airport, got us on a bus. And we all kind of just slept because it was real late that night. And I remember it was about, I think, sometime after midnight, 1 o'clock, when we arrived at the gates of Parris Island. And all of a sudden, we just heard somebody hollering for all the ladies to get off the bus. everybody's just standing around or sleeping and not paying any attention because there wasn't any ladies we knew of on the bus.
Right.
Next thing we know, this guy right up in our face, two of them, and they're hollering, talking about us scumbags and names I never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they finally got our attention. We all got off the bus, and they made us go sit at the benches with our feet on the little yellow footmarks and things, and set at attention until somebody came and got us. And so I think we sat there for 30 minutes or an hour or something before a couple trucks came by and picked us up.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us that night to a barracks. And there's a DI waiting for us. He actually had us write a little letter home, a little postcard saying we had arrived, not to worry about us. You might not hear us for a while. Then they took us back, and what we thought was going to get a good night's sleep lasted about 2 hours.
Right.
Next thing we know, we're up, and these guys are marching us all over the place and hollering at us. And it's like I told some people at church the other night when I was giving my testimony. I went from one abusive father to four abusive drill instructors.
Right.
So, but it all paid off in the end. So.
Mm-hmm.
But Paris Island was one of those fun places. You know, the recruiters tell you about all these wonderful islands you're going to see and exotic places. And I guess that was the first island I got to see, and it wasn't so exotic. But,
right.
Anyway, we had three good drill instructors. At that time, there were two sergeants and a corporal, because rank was hard to make back in Marine Corps right there at 65.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that corporal, I think, had been in like 12 years or something, but he had a engineering MOS, and he was kind of mad at the world and had a black belt also in karate, and so he liked to let everybody know, you know, what his moves were by, you know, popping us every now and then. But
mm-hmm.
back in those days, drill instructors were able to kind of hit you or, you know, do a lot more things than they're allowed to do now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, to toughen you up and get your attention. So, you know, once you get out of there, you say, hey, I survived it, and you feel good about it. But, you know, when you're going through it, it's like, man, what did I get myself into here?
Mm-hmm.
And back in those days at Paris Island, you could not speak, you know, unless you were asked a question or talked to by the DI. And if they caught you talking any time to one of your roommates or guys, you know, you'd get punished.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we spent just about all that time, you know, being quiet. And every now and then, you know, just trying to get a word or two in when we couldn't see the DI around, you know, like all kids try to get away with a little something.
Right.
But every now and then they'd sneak in and catch us, and, you know, we'd pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the training was about as tough and vigorous as I could ever imagine. I mean, when you're watching those war movies, you sure didn't see all this stuff going on that you went through at boot camp. But it turned out that some of the things you did see, you know, it's like, wow, you know, I saw them doing this, and now I'm doing it. And,
right.
You know, it made you think a little bit. But didn't get to eat much, and what you did get to eat, you had to eat in a hurry, and there's always something going on from the time you got up to the time you went to sleep. And you're always spit-shining everything you had, and making sure your lock was always, you know, closed and fast on your locker or somebody that didn't lock up their locker and left it open would cause all of us to have punishment and stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's all just trying to tell you, you know, when I tell you to do something, do it, you know.
Right.
If one messes up, everybody messes up. So,
mm-hmm.
kind of like life in a way.
Right.
But, again, the training was hard. The drill instructors, they did their part. And, of course, at the end of it, you know, they talked to us about what they were doing, and they all seemed like different people at that time, and I got to meet one of them later in Vietnam, and so it was pretty interesting time. Sometimes I think it, besides Vietnam, it's probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right.
A lot of sweat, a lot of tired bones, and you got rid of a lot of your baby fat. And you were a little more solid when you came home, and you walked taller, and you know, you felt good about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it was tough, especially getting up early and staying awake and knowing that that bed was right there beside you sometimes. You can't even lay down in it.
Mm-hmm.
But,
right.
It was different.
All right. Okay. Now these the drill instructors, were most of these guys veterans by this point? Were they Korean War? Vietnam War?
Veterans.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see. What about weapons training? What type of weapons were you training on at this point?
The first weapon we had was an M1.
Okay.
And when we went to the rifle range, I believe we had M14s that we shot on the rifle range.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been so long ago. I know we started out with M1s. And we might have shot M1s at the rifle range, but I almost think that somewhere in between there, they gave us 14s to
mm-hmm.
shoot.
Okay.
That I'm not very, but I can't remember offhand.
Right. All right. Well, would you have, this is skipping ahead a little bit, I know, but mm-hmm. would you have the M14 in Vietnam or M16?
No, I had the M16, and most of the time I carried a 45 with me in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So, but prior to going to Vietnam, there you guys had not had any training on the M16, just the 14.
No.
Or the M1? Okay.
No.
And
the only thing we had was the M1, the M14, and of course all the other weapons we got to fire on the Camp Geiger.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay. All right. Well. All right. Let's see. Well, I guess by the time you were in Vietnam, had the problems been worked out with the M16 by that point?
Most of them. We still had, a lot of times the 16s would still jam on us or,
mm-hmm.
Something would mess up. But the majority of the time, probably 90% of the time, we didn't have too many problems with the 16s, by the time I got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, as far as the training goes, so would you say that it sufficiently prepare you for being a Marine? The training that you got at boot camp.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably the best training you could get anywhere at that time.
Right.
Because back in '65, you got what I call the old original Marine Corps training. It was just a hardened birdie.
Mm-hmm. All right. During the training, was there any specific focus or mention of Vietnam at that point?
Well, not really. There was. I hadn't really even heard of Vietnam that much because I didn't care about listening to the news and stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't get any news. Period. When we were at Parris Island.
Right.
So we were kind of no TV, no radio, no nothing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some inklings every now and then. You hear somebody say something, about Vietnam or Korea or something. But there wasn't, much going on really in June and July of '65. That was when things were just kind of picking up in Vietnam. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well,
once we got to Camp Geiger, you started hearing a little bit more, about if it could be a chance that everybody was heading to Vietnam or something. So,
mm-hmm.
Parris Island, I didn't really know, really what was going on, period. I couldn't even tell you what was going on, with my own guys that I was in the barracks with because everything was so quiet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. All right. Well, before moving on to advanced training, were there any particular memorable moments or humorous moments or anything like that from boot camp that stand out in your mind?
Well, a lot of times things that were humorous were people really getting smacked or doing something stupid. And they're not so humorous when they're you that's getting hit and smacked.
Sure.
Watching a guy not do what he's told and the drill instructor put the 50-gallon or 30-gallon, whatever it was, garbage can on top of his head.
Right.
And, everybody has to get around, and he has to start kind of walking, and everybody has to push him back in a circle and hit the can. And, Mm-hmm. Of course, we wasn't allowed to laugh or anything, but inside, you know, it's kind of funny watching somebody walk around with a garbage can on their head, but
mm-hmm.
it was kind of sad, too, because you knew it didn't felt good or feel good to get hit.
Right.
Every time you got too close to somebody, and if you didn't hit them or push them back in there, then the DI would come to you, and, you know, you'd liable to be in the garbage can.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, some of the funny things were, you know, watching people turn left when they should have turned right, or, you mm-hmm. know, and now they're thinking about home or something, or, you know, wondering what they got themselves into.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Out on the firing range, you know, watching people who couldn't shoot. You'd find five DIs over one guy, you know, calling him every name there is. You know, the guy had so much pressure on him, he was shooting other people's targets.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of fun times, but, you know, you can look back and, you know, see a few things that happened. And having a couple guys from high school made it a little bit better. Even though you couldn't talk to them or do anything, when you got a chance, you felt like you still had a piece of home with you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Sure. All right. So, overall, did you feel that you were adjusting to the Marine lifestyle pretty well? Or?
I was. Toward, I guess, the last few weeks, felt better,
mm-hmm.
you know, after getting through most of the instruction and, you know, some of the tougher book part of it. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, until we finally went out to the rifle range and got back and started doing some of our tests and things, you know, I started getting more comfortable as it started getting behind me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're always scared that you're the one that's going to fail. And, usually, you know, if you had, I think back then, I think we started off with like 60 or 70 guys, and I think we ended up with about, you know, 45 or 50 of us graduating. So, you know, you tried to do your best, you know, not to fall out or go to that other battalion, you know, where they would take the guys who were too fat or too slow or just not making it, and know that you'd have to go back and do a lot of that training over again. So,
right.
You know, I was trying to do everything I can to get through at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah. So I thought it was a good training. It prepared me for later.
Mm-hmm. All right. So those who failed the first time, then they would be just recycled through to another unit? Is that what would happen?
Yeah, they had their motivation unit, as they called it. And, if you got too far behind and you couldn't make it past each step, then you were recycled to your motivation battalion, and then that group would take you and recycle you again later.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd get you to a point where you could get past what your problems were. If you're overweight and had a problem getting through the obstacle courses, then you went on a diet, and they would get you to the point where you could make it through the obstacle courses and stuff. And so that's the self-motivation stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
You never did see anybody once they left. And so I'm sure some of them probably didn't even make it, you know, through the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had, you know, your percentage of guys that got in there and found out it wasn't what they wanted, and they did everything in the world they could to get discharged. So,
mm-hmm.
But you'd have a few of those guys scattered about, too. So.
Right, right. All right. See, and you said you went to Camp Geiger for AIT?
Right.
Okay. All right. Where was where's Camp Geiger located?
That's down, I believe it's right outside of Pendleton, not Pendleton, but Lejeune out that way. I can't remember if it's in South Carolina or North Carolina.
Okay.
But it's where we went next. They loaded us up on buses and sent us all over to Camp Geiger. And I can't remember if we spent like 4 weeks there, exactly how many weeks it was, but that's where we learned to be more in an organization for us, working patrols and, you know, working in company formations and doing some mock little battles and things, and learned more teamwork, you know, within units and things. And
mm-hmm.
We got to, you know, throw the grenades and fire the different weapons, and most of our live training was there. So
mm-hmm.
that's where it was not as hard as Paris Island. It was a little bit more fun by the things that we were getting to do, shooting the weapons, and but it was, you know, still to the point of not like drill instructors, but the guys we had over us, you know, still getting us up early and, you know, going to bed late. And in between, we're always out moving around, walking in formation, just learning to, the movement of a company and a platoon and different sizes of units.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more fun. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like watching the war movies, except people wasn't really shooting at you, and kind of learning a little bit more about what it was like to stay awake at night. And I know wherever we were, it was cold because it was kind of getting into the winter time. Mm-hmm. And so I remember one night being on the radio, and I was about to freeze to death. And it's like, man, I don't know if I'll ever make it through this, having to stay awake. It was kind of tough to understand that, you know, this is for real. You know, you can't just go to sleep here.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you said here that there began to be more talk about Vietnam at this point?
Yeah. Well, we got to Camp Geiger, you know, where we're Marines, and basically the talk, you know, was anything and everything then. And, of course, I didn't care. You know, it's like I didn't have any control much over anything, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't really worry about it. Didn't worry about the little things I was hearing about. They were getting ready to send units, Marine units, over to Nam, and I'm not sure if the 4th Marines had already landed at that time, that battalion, or if that was later in 65 or about that same time or what, but
mm-hmm.
I think it was the 4th Marines at a battalion, I think, landed in Vietnam there in 65. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a lot of talk, you know, going on about, well, there's some Marines there now, you know, so the war's going to be over before long. So, you know, all the macho talk.
Right. Was that, I've heard this from other guys, but was that one of the things that the guys were talking about, wanting to get there kind of, I guess, before it ended, believing that once they got there it'd be over pretty fast, so they wanted to hurry up and get there?
Well, you know, there's a lot of movies that you see every now and then, and what they say, excuse me, what
sure.
they say is true, and that's that, you know, most young guys, they go through the Marine Corps and the training and everything, and they all of a sudden they've gone from wimps to being macho guys, and so they hear about, you know, fighting and war, and that's what they're trained for, so they're ready to go to it and get it done and get it over with and come out the victor, and
mm-hmm.
not realizing that once you get to war, what really happens.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the guys were, you know, ready to go. So
right.
You know, I could care less. It's like, you know, I'd go wherever they tell me, so I didn't have a choice, the way I looked at it.
Right, sure. All right. Was, I guess, during this point in your training, I guess there was a, from what I'm getting, was it more focused in on just the tactics and how to operate in the field?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And,
and a lot of guys who had different MOSs that wasn't infantry or whatever, some of them had left to go off to radio training and stuff like that at that time. But majority of the guys all went through the training, and then a lot of them left afterwards
mm-hmm.
to go into their different MOSs.
Mm-hmm. All right. And did you feel that this training was pretty sufficient as far as preparing you for Vietnam?
I don't think anything prepares you for Vietnam once you get there, but that training and the training I would later go through over at Pendleton at back in the end of 67, where they had mock Vietnam villages and stuff for us to kind of practice running through and patrolling through, I think that helped us also.
Okay.
So Camp Geiger and Paris Island really got you motivated, got you in condition, got you trained to go face the world and take orders, and so, you know, that part really helped you be prepared.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any particular memorable moments here? Any other moments that stick out in your mind from this training?
well, just throwing the grenades, and, you know, you have some people that gets kind of stupid, you know, kind of let it go in the wrong time. But, you know, most of that was pretty straightforward. Go out and fire the different weapons and fire the flamethrower and shoot the bazooka once and throw your grenades. And it was all kind of fun, but it was kind of scary, too, knowing that this was real, you know. Made a mistake, you could get hurt, or somebody else would get hurt.
Right.
It was more loose then, since we could talk and chat, and we all felt a whole lot better about ourselves. So we felt like, you know, people again, you know.
Right. All right. How was discipline enforced here? If there were discipline problems at this point?
Well, I can tell you, one night, everybody got their first little leave to go in town, I think just that night, and I was so tired I just said I was going to sleep. So I remember I lay down on my bunk and went to sleep. And then at nighttime, everybody's supposed to be back at a certain time, and I'm still laying on my bunk asleep. Nobody woke me up, and they came in to do the night inspection. And all of a sudden, I was on my bunk when they were going through, and one guy tried to wake me up, and I got up real quick. But the instructor saw that I just got out of the bunk. He was really mad that I wasn't standing at attention. So I had to end up eating potatoes for the next 6 hours, I think. So I remember that. And I was so mad at the guys around me for not waking me up, you know.
Right.
They were so happy from coming back from leave, and half of them were drunk, and so I was pretty upset at my guys. You know, I didn't know a lot of them, but the couple I knew, I was kind of mad at for not waking me up.
Sure.
Yeah, I sure didn't like staying up the rest of the night peeling potatoes.
Right.
It was fun. I enjoyed Camp Geiger.
All right, and at that point, when Camp Geiger was finished, was that when you were given your first assignment at that point?
Yeah, I received my orders to go to camp in June to report to the Echo Company 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines.
Okay.
And I had leave before then, so I went home on leave. First time the family got to see me in my uniform. They couldn't come out for graduation.
Right.
And so I ate all the hamburgers and french fries and tried to get all the fat back I could in the 20 days.
Right.
And then I left, and I took a bus from Memphis to out to Camp Lejeune, and went and joined the Echo Company. And of course, being a new guy, you know, you got all the duties and everything. And stayed out there a few months, and then we received orders to go to Morehead City and just get aboard a ship out there and proceed on to Cuba for a four-month stay in Cuba.
Okay.
So that was where my first duty station was after we left Lejeune. We wasn't there. I wasn't there but a couple months before we went to Cuba and took over guard duty there on that base for 4 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Did you talk a little bit about that, what that was like for you, being in Cuba? What was it? I would assume it was at Guantanamo Bay?
Yes, it was.
Okay. All right.
The best thing I can say about Cuba is another island that the drill instructor promised I would probably see.
Right.
So I'm two for two, Paris Island, now Cuba.
Uh-huh.
And, anyway, get to Cuba, and we're over on, I think it's what they call the leeward side. It was the far side of the bay. So we went around where the ships were, and they had one company that they kept on the leeward side, and that just happened to be our company. And all we did was pull guard duty, and there were towers all around the fence there. And the Cubans had towers on their side of the fence. There were minefields in between on our side and their side, and there was one road on our side and one road on their side. And we just stood there and looked at each other 24 hours a day. And sometimes we would walk patrols down on the roads and stuff, but most of the time with all the minefields and stuff around there, we would be assigned to a tower, and that's where we would stay and until we were relieved. We had a barracks, we had a little movie theater, and we had a little club. And that's all we had on the leeward side. So, you know, again, you know, I'm to a place where there's no women, and, you know, I didn't drink. And so,
right.
You know, it was, to me, like the worst duty a man could ever imagine.
So, right.
But, you know, I kept thinking this Marine Corps is not getting any better here. But anyway, we spent that time, and just like I say, in the bunkers and the towers, watching and running drills up in the hills and the mountains, and every now and then we'd hear stories about you know, the Cubans trying to sneak across the fence or something, and nobody ever found anybody, or that was before that guy finally got shot. And somebody, one of the guys shot him, he fell back on the Cuban side. There's kind of a big stink about that. They were mad because they didn't wait and get the guy when he got on our side. But that was about it. It was probably the most dullest duty I ever had in my life. I know it's definitely boring. You know, there's no women, no girls. And you know, all you could do is drink if you like to drink and go to a movie.
Right.
Sit around. And it was like, you know, I guess it was better being in Vietnam at the time, but it was still like, you know, I don't understand this Marine Corps, you know.
Right.
So hopefully things are going to get better here.
Right.
But then we loaded ship and then headed back to Camp Lejeune and got there. And as we all debarked, most of us were given new orders. And most of the guys, after we got back to Cuba from the 8th Marines, were given orders to Vietnam.
Okay.
And I, for some reason, was given duty at Marine Barracks, Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Okay.
It's called Clarksville Base. Clarksville Base is one of those top secret places at the time. And I had to get a top secret clearance and final top secret clearance. And it's like, what in the world's a Marines doing in an Army base at Fort Campbell, Kentucky? So,
right.
But it wasn't an island, so I thought it was getting better anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sure. And what was your job there?
I was a guard there. I remember going to Fort Campbell, pulling up on the bus there, whatever the little town was in Tennessee, right there on the border. And taking a cab out to the gates of Fort Campbell, and I was still surprised because here I am in a Marine uniform, and I got hundreds, not thousands, of Army guys walking by me all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was beginning to think that somebody had messed up on my orders.
Right.
And I told this guy when I got there, I said, well, I'm reporting in the Clarksville base. And he told me, just go over and sit down. And had to have a Jeep pick me up in a little while. So I sat down for about an hour, and finally a Jeep came by and picked me up. And all of a sudden, we started driving toward this place that looked like a prison. And I said, my God, what have I got myself into now? I'm on prison duty or something.
Right.
And back then, that was one of the most top secret places in the United States, and it's where they used to, one of the two places they used to have nuclear warheads at the time.
Okay.
And so our job was to guard the nuclear warheads. And so they had a very interesting place, but it's like five fences spread out. And the middle fence was electrified. And there had lights all around the whole base. And the whole place was electrified around it. And our job was to pull either stationary guard duty at the two bridges or at the gate or at some of the mandatory locations. Or we rode around in gray pickup trucks, two men or one man to a truck. 24 hours a day, making sure that the facility was always safe and guarded.
Mm-hmm.
But we were stationed there with a detachment of Navy CBs.
Okay.
And that was our job. The Navy CBs took care of the nuclear warheads, and our job was to make sure that all the kind of like bunkers that are built into the mountains where the nuclear warheads are stored, and several underground leaded buildings were all protected. And we went around making sure that the seals were on them all the time, and just making sure that the two bridges that had a little creek or river that ran through the base was always secure, and the gates were always open, ours closed. And so that's what we did. But we went around with live ammunition,
mm-hmm.
and it was our job to make sure that nobody ever got on our side of the base. Even the Army were not allowed to walk on our side of the base, and a lot of times we'd have to go outside the base and remind them that they needed to get back on the other side of the street. And Army didn't like us being there at all.
Right.
And, there was a no-fly area over the base, and so it was pretty interesting duty. But we were told, you know, not to look like Marines and let our hair grow long. And so that part was good.
Right.
So, you know, when I went home, I was only about 3 hours from Memphis because it was up, you know, up close toward Nashville, up toward the Kentucky line there, on the Kentucky line. And so when I went home, you know, everybody was saying, man, what happened to you? You're not in Marines anymore? Just because my hair was long.
So, right.
But they didn't want us to look like Marines, so if we went to town or something, you know, if there's any spies or anybody out there would, you know, look at us and start wanting to get a conversation up with us or something. So
mm-hmm.
back then we were, you know, strict orders that we couldn't talk about the base, what was inside the base, but all that's been turned over to the Army and pretty well changed now. So.
Right. All right. When you weren't on duty here, how would you spend your free time?
We worked 3 days on, 3 days off.
Okay.
So when I was off, I would either sleep or hang out with some of the guys. We'd go to town.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, I would head back to Memphis. And I was usually, you know, in Memphis two or three times a month, you know, for 2 or 3 days, you know, each time. So
mm-hmm.
It was nice having a duty station close to home. So.
Right, sure.
But most of my time, I'd get off duty and get a little sleep and just head back home,
mm-hmm.
and hang out with my friends and date and different things.
Right. All right.
But that's where I ended up making corporal real fast while I was there. So, you know, within 2 years, I was already an E4.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, rank was really moving at that time.
Mm-hmm. How long were you there in this duty?
I was there probably about a year and a half.
Okay.
And it's supposed to have been a 2-year duty assignment, I was told. But after I made corporal, Vietnam was having a hard time filling slots for NCOs. So I got redlined as soon as I made corporal. And I guess probably about 4 months later, as a matter of fact, it was right before Thanksgiving of 67, they called me in and told me I had orders, and I said, oh, great, man, you know, I love this place. And I couldn't imagine, because by then we had guys coming to the barracks that were coming back from Vietnam, so we were starting to hear the war stories of what was going on over there. And most of us knew that when we got orders, it wasn't good, you know, that they would be heading us over to Vietnam. So as soon as I got it, I kind of cringed, and I knew that that's where I was going to end up. And so I went home on leave on Thanksgiving and told my parents, and I'd gotten married a couple months before.
Okay.
The little girl I met on leave, and so I told her. And then I came home for 20 days leave at Christmas, and my orders basically said for me to report to Camp Pendleton I forgot what the name of the unit was, but it was kind of a fill-in unit to prepare for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to be over there, I think, the 3rd of January. So,
okay.
So I just went home on leave and kissed everybody goodbye and caught a plane and went out to Pendleton, and they put me in a little unit just preparing us for the next 30 days, 4 weeks, to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this was some extra training right at the end before going to get you ready for Vietnam?
Yeah. It was what they call jungle warfare training.
Okay.
So they had a mock bases and people acting like Vietnamese, and they would run us through mine training that we really hadn't before. What to do if you found a mine or booby trap, what to look out for, how to sweep a village, what to look out for in booby traps and ambushes. And, you know, they got us back into the physical training more than, you know, we were in at the Marine barracks. And
mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of running up and down the hills over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they finally, every so often would pick a couple guys out and tell us, you know, we were on our way to Vietnam, report over to El Toro, and get our instructions there. So we finally got my orders, and I went over there, and later that afternoon they put me on a flight heading toward Vietnam. I think it was me and about 150 other guys or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a Pan Am flight.
Mm-hmm.
And last time we saw some nice round-eyed women, you know, a few stewardesses around there.
Right.
And we flew into Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. All right. What was the mood like on the plane among the guys? Was there any talk about Vietnam?
Nah, no, there wasn't a whole lot. There's, you know, your few guys that were gung-ho still. And
mm-hmm.
By then, a lot of people had already heard the war stories and saw what happens, the scars, some of the guys coming back. And a lot of people just took time and they read and they were quiet. And
mm-hmm.
Other guys just chatted about home and stuff. And until you're really there, even people telling you something about it, you really can't imagine the horror that you're fixing to see. So,
mm-hmm. Right.
I know, I just kind of lay back and slept and, you know, enjoyed our stay. And we flew into Guam and at night and refueled. And I remember we got off the plane. They told us to go into the terminal. You couldn't go anywhere. Of course, if you've ever been to Guam, there's nowhere to go anywhere. But the thing that was interesting to me is when we got off the plane in Guam, between us and the terminal, they had guards posted. So you had to walk between the guards all the way to the terminal. Once you were in the room in the terminal, you couldn't go anywhere because those doors were locked and there were guards there.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's time to get back on the plane, you had to walk back through the guards. So undoubtedly they'd had some people that went AWOL or something in the past, they were making sure, you know, no one was going AWOL this time. So
right.
They had guards all the way, you know, to make sure that we did what we told and we got back on the plane. So, but I thought that was kind of interesting when I first saw it. It was like, man, they want to make sure we get there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
But I remember flying into Da Nang and the pilot coming on and saying, ladies and gentlemen, you know, welcome to Republic of Vietnam. And I would be approaching Da Nang here shortly. So, you know, take your seats. And
mm-hmm.
I just remember, you know, saying a little prayer, you know, saying, Lord, I just pray you get as many men home as I can possibly get, you know. And
mm-hmm.
many years later, I said, you know, I forgot to even pray for myself. I was praying for men. And that time, I didn't even know I'd have any men or not. So
right.
It's kind of strange when I look back at it and saw how it turned out.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. what was your first impression of Vietnam?
I would take Cuba any day. But it was morning when we got there. It was still hot and sweaty, and it's like as soon as you walked outside, it was like, you know, just feeling the heat. And just wanted to go into the air conditioning somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we walked down the stairs and out to where these guys were standing, and they took us over to this one area, and you know, the anticipation was kind of scary because all around you, you saw this activity going on at Da Nang, and you know, you saw the coffin boxes, you know, stacked up over on kind of to the right of us as we was walking toward where we were going, the tent we were going to, and and it's like, man, are those just empty boxes or people in them, or you know, it kind of got your mind thinking a little bit. And then you started seeing the Vietnamese guys walking around that were supposed to be on our side, and said us that's what they look like. And then you see all these grungy guys, and then you see some spit and shiny guys, and said, man, I wonder what we got ourselves into here. And then they took us over to this tent and got us in line by our alphabet. And so we went through that, and as we went up there and rattled off her name, they gave us our orders of where we'd be going to from there. In my case, I was assigned to the 7th Marines. Again, it was Echo Company 2nd Battalion, kind of like the 8th Marines. But anyway, they told me I was going to a rifle outfit. And when I left the States, because I had a final top secret clearance, they said, well, you got it made, you know, don't worry about it. You'll be back in the rear since you have a final top secret clearance. You know, they won't let you out in the field. And when I got there, they used my original MOS 0311, and they sent me to a rifle outfit. And I said, well, you know, I got a final top secret clearance. And they said, well, it doesn't matter. These are your orders. So I said, all right. So anyway, I was kind of surprised, but they told me that I couldn't go out to my outfit till the next day, and there'd be three of us that would be going out. And another guy pointed to a tent, told us to go over there and find a cot and go find some chow and just stay right there within that area of the mess hall, and that we'd be picked up the next morning. So they told us to be ready by 10 o'clock. And so I went over there and didn't know who the other two guys were at the time. And so I found me a cot and lay down, and you know, it was too hot. So I got up, went to find me the mess hall, and stayed over there for a while. And then I came back and just started talking. Some of the guys starting to float in, and then that night they rocketed the thing. So we had to all get out and then go to these underground bunkers, and it was like I was just watching these rockets. You know, like, man, this is cool. You know. Then I started realizing, you know, if one of those hit anywhere close, you know, I could be dead. So
right.
I started thinking about, you know, what death meant at the time. So never really seen too many people dead before. And anyway, next morning got up, and hit chow, came back, and in our green utilities and black boots, and then guy pulled up, said, anybody for Echo 2-7? The ride is over here. And so me and two other guys fell out, a guy named Jones, a guy named Music, and we got on that Jeep, rode out to a hill 190, and that's where Echo Company was at the moment. They just came in from the SO plant and from TED and by way, and so went and joined them on this hill, and they had a CAC unit down below them. And then saw a bunch of bombed out vehicles between Da Nang and going out to Hill 190. And so we got there, and this country looked real pretty, and the rice fields were kind of like Arkansas in a way. I kind of used to the rice fields and stuff, but you know, just the people we passed were looking different. And you know, you started thinking, you know, I got 13 months here, and this is only the first day,
right?
So anyway, got to 190. They told us to leave our bags right there where the Jeep pulled up, and we went up to meet the captain. So I went up to the CO, and he welcomed us to Echo Company and told us a little bit about the outfit. They'd just gotten back from Tet, and they're just settling in on 190 right now. They were short of a lot of personnel. And I was the only NCO. The other two guys, I think, were either private or Lance Corporal.
Okay.
And a couple of lieutenants started coming in, and they told us just to sit over there where they tried to decide what was the best platoon or where we were supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And about 30, 40 minutes later, a lieutenant named Lieutenant Pippin walked in, and captain introduced me to him and said, Lieutenant Pippin, Corporal Storrs is going to be assigned to you, and he's been a corporal for so long and everything, and so he's actually the senior corporal that you've got in your platoon. So they asked him what he wanted to do with me, and he said, well, right now they put me in as a right guide, and it's been a long time, so I remember what a right guide was. So I started thinking, well, I guess I can always ask the left guide what that is. So,
right.
And of course, there ain't no left guides. So, you know, had no idea what I just became.
Right.
So, anyway, he takes me back to this little bunker, and the guys are already out on guard duty, and the ones that are supposed to be. And so I go in there, and I meet the staff sergeant, who's a platoon sergeant. And lieutenant says, well, Corporal Storrs here is our senior corporal, so we're going to give him the temporary slot of right guide. And so I finally asked. I said, you know, it's been a while I've been in Marine Barracks. You know, what's my duties as a right guide? And he said, well, you're third in command.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, third in command? I just got here. You know,
right.
I'm only a corporal.
Right.
And something didn't sound right. And anyway, as the senior corporal, I became the right guide, third in command of the platoon, and had a lieutenant and a staff sergeant, and he was getting ready to rotate home in about a month. And so I figured, well, this won't last long. So they told me my duties, you know, that I'd be in charge of making sure of supplies, and we took care of the men all the time, and I kind of did all the dirty duty, you know, the lieutenant and staff sergeant didn't have to do. And so I met my squad leaders and the radio guys, and I remember that night they said, well, just stay here in the hoots tonight since we already got everybody out posted, and we'll get you meeting everybody. And that night somebody shot, the whole line opened up, and finally, you know, it's like, what in the world do I do? I hadn't even received my rifle or anything at that time, and so I just kind of went to the closest bunker and got in it, and finally one of the guys on the line had shot himself in the foot.
Mm.
And they found out it wasn't by accident, and so he was later court-martialed, but I had to go take his place that night and took his rifle and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So next morning, you know, sun comes up, and the other guys had already told me they'd pulled their duty, so you know, I kind of got zapped on that. I had to stay up, you know, rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next morning, you know, they introduced me to the guys and tell me I was going to be the temporary right guide.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started getting to know everybody and got my gear and everything assigned to me and got some jungle utilities, some jungle boots. So they gave me a M16. And so that night I went on my first patrol. One guy hit a booby trap and lost his leg.
Mm.
Remember, a chopper came in, and I found his foot, and it was still inside the boot. So I picked it up, put it on the chopper beside the guy, and said, boy, I sure don't like these booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the next about, I guess, month, we ran patrols and things off 190 and up in the Elephant Valley up the river there on Amtrak's. And that's about all we ran into it for that first month, which is booby traps and things. But I started getting to know the men and got used to my right guide position. Then we got word that we were going to float, that we'd probably go to the Philippines and regroup. And by then we started getting into some operations and started getting hit pretty hard. Lose a lot of guys, and I remember we went to the Philippines and picked up a whole bunch of lieutenants, and my lieutenant went over. He had already had his 6 months in the field, so Lieutenant Pippin moved over to S2, S3 or something, and mm-hmm. we got a new lieutenant in named Toya. And we already got a new staff sergeant in named Staff Sergeant Lutu from America Samoa, one of the meanest, toughest guys you'd ever seen in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't pronounce my name. So when he got there about, March, April, he couldn't say our stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sergeant in April 1st.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to call me Sergeant Story. So I went through my whole time from that time on till I left being known as Sergeant Story.
Right.
So I didn't even have my real name when I was over there. But they made me sergeant right after I found the name had got rocketed. And they sent us out as a reinforced platoon to the site where they thought the rockets had came from. And we had the engineers with us. And instead of dropping us on top of this big old mountain, they made us walk all the way up it. So by the time we got to the top of it, we was exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up there, and we still had Lieutenant Pippin at the time, and he was going to take one of the squads and go down this kind of fork off the hill, the mountain. And he told me to stay up here on the highest part and just watch the back door and around us. So we did. We sat down, posted the guards, and when I sat down, I saw three little pieces of bamboo right in front of me, and I looked at it, and I said, I remember in jungle warfare, and I said, those are signs. And so I got up, and I already taken my weld gear off and put my rifle down. I had my radio guy beside me, and I said, I'm going to see where these markers are going to. So I got up, and there's a kind of a big boulder right in front of me, and like a drop-off from there going down into the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of pointed right at the boulder, like a bush right there. So, you know, being kind of a new guy, not into real big battles at the time, mm-hmm. I walked over there, kind of looked, and kind of pushed the bush out of the way, and it moved. I said, there's a trail going down off this hill. And it looked like a drop-off. So anyway, I just started diddy bopping down a little bit. And as soon as I turned around the big boulder, there's a rifle standing there and some rice that was been cooked. And I said, oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
So I hollered up there for him to call the lieutenant and get the radio down and bring my weapon. And I just knew I was a dead man standing there like a stupid new guy.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, they came down and we found a big cave up under where we had been sitting. And it had a hospital and all kind of weapons, and undoubtedly the couple guys that were guards or whatever didn't want to mess with us, and they'd taken off real quick. One of them left a rifle.
Hmm.
So we got word to blow the place up after they took a bunch of pictures and stuff of it. So we blew it up, and when I got back, they promoted me to sergeant.
Hmm.
And I said, man, you know, I just did something stupid that could have got me killed, and I'd make sergeant out of it.
Right.
So anyway, I was still the right guy, and I ended up staying the right guy the whole time I was there. I never went down to squad leader or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm probably one of the few guys can say that, you know, I started off as a corporal, as a right guy, and ended up being a right guy.
Mm-hmm.
And later I'd be a platoon sergeant, and four times I'd take over the platoon, you know, in the next 13 months. So.
Mm, okay, wow.
We just didn't have any rank.
Right.
And when we got ranked, they didn't last long.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh.
I was very lucky. I was one of about three guys. I was the only NCO officer that went the whole 13 months.
Oh, wow.
In Echo Company. So I saw it all, everybody come and go. When we have our reunions, I can recount more since I was one of the few guys that made it all the way through 68.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, the weird thing was the three of us that rode that Jeep in on 68,
mm-hmm.
we rode that Jeep out in 69.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't imagine the odds of three of us going to Echo Company, and although the other two guys that were wounded at different times, that the three of us would make it out of there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But And we're about the only three that went the whole tour. I bet we probably went through about 200% casualties in Echo Company in 68. So.
Oh, wow. Right. All right. Could you talk a little bit about it? You don't have to go into specific names if you don't want to, but just the group dynamic and the makeup of the unit, and did everyone seem to get along fairly well, and about talk about morale and all that?
Yeah, we had good morale, especially in our group. I know a lot of other units I hear didn't, but we didn't have a lot of drugs and stuff. Mm-hmm. Every now and then we'd catch some new guys coming in or something, but mm-hmm. they'd catch a few of the rear pokies, you know, that were in the rear every now and then. But most of the guys we had on the front line, we knew that we had to trust each other. And,
sure.
You know, that if one of us slipped, we were in trouble. And we had pretty good morale there for a while. That Black Power thing kind of took, you know, over, but most of that was in the rear, and mm-hmm. the guys we had out in front were basically told real quick, you know, not to even go there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our officers and us as the NCOs, we didn't put up for anybody thinking they were better than anybody else. And they mm-hmm. said, you know, basically my line was, if you think you're that good, I'm gonna let you walk point.
Right.
So, you know, and everybody didn't want to walk point. We only had a few crazy guys that wanted to do that. But anyway, I didn't have a problem with morale. Actually, we went through so many turnovers that there wasn't that time for a lot of bonding.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who did bond, they usually wasn't together for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
More so toward the end of 68, November, December, going into January. But we had so many big operations that, you know, our company, at several points, we got down just to, you know, August 18th. We had 41 guys that walked out out of the whole company.
Wow.
And we've had other battles before that, you know, where there'd be 60 or 70 of us left. But I know from August, I think out of that 41 guys, by the time December got around, there were about 12 of us 41 left. And by the time I left in February, there was probably about six of us left. So, but, you know, our morale was good with each other because, you know, that's all we had was each other.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about home, and I didn't get real close to the men, like most NCOs. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I had some of my favorites, but, you know, when they'd get killed or wounded, you know, it kind of hurt. So
mm-hmm.
you just got to the point where, you know, everybody had a nickname, basically. And so, you know, we called everybody Hawkeye, Branch, you know, a Swamp Rat, you know, different things. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, Wildy Call, Coyote, or, you know.
Right.
So a lot of times you didn't even know their names, you know, except on paper. I had to know them because I had to report all the casualties and stuff. But I knew the guys a lot better than even the squad leaders did. But I didn't have any problem with morale. We had people that would come that... there when the Marines started taking people that were going to jail, and the judge would say, you can go to Marines or go to jail. They'd take the Marines, and they didn't like to be there. And then you had a lot of people that started getting drafted that didn't want to be there and for 2 years. And we had more problems with those folks than anybody. And most of the time they'd do stupid things or you know, try to do something to get them out of the fighting part. But, most of the guys that volunteered, you know, for their 4 years were pretty steady guys. So,
All right.
I enjoyed them. And, you know, we started our reunions about 15 years ago, one of the last Marine companies to do that. And it's been fun kind of sitting around talking to them.
But, sure.
But we watched each other and backed each other up. And like I say, I went through four lieutenants and five captains while I was there. And, you know, I saw the whole platoon. My platoon probably went through about three times as many guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
All right.
And then when you end up looking at it, you know, Echo Company, I think, lost 88 guys, 88 or 89 men were killed in Vietnam. So, you know.
Right. All right. When a replacement would come in for one of the original guys, was there, what would it be like at that point? Would the other guys tend to distance themselves until he proved himself? I mean, I guess I'm going on a stereotype here from what I've seen on TV and in the movies, but
well, in most cases, you know, people had to prove themselves. You know, a new guy would come in. A lot of times it would depend on the new guy. A lot of times a guy could come in and have a good personality and guys would pick up on him real quick and, you know. Or if he came in and he was assigned to a squad and he was from the same state or same city as a guy or two, he was more accepted real quick than somebody else.
Right.
But in most cases, a guy would come in and they would sign him to a, you know, a team. And the team leader would tell him, you know, you're just a rifleman, just do what I tell you. And, you know, everybody would, just his little team would really kind of get to know him, and then maybe his squad. And it wasn't like, you know, everybody would welcome him to the fraternity.
Right.
You know? But, you know, my job, basically, once the lieutenant assigned him, usually the platoon sergeant in most cases would assign him to the squad leader, and then I would take him over or go with the squad leader and introduce him, and then he was kind of on his own. And, you know, a lot of people would call me and knew who I was, but I didn't, you know, just hang around with them. I'd stop by and check their morale and make sure they got all the food and ammo they needed, and that was my job. So I did that more than the platoon sergeant. So I kind of knew the guys a little bit more than the lieutenant or the staff sergeant in most cases, but, you know, at first anyway.
All right. Okay. I wanted to ask you about the time as far as you, when you first arrived in country. Had Ted already taken place by that point, or was it going on? Or?
It was at the end.
Okay.
I got there right at the end of Ted.
Okay.
February, I think it was February 1st, February 2nd when I arrived. And, most of what I saw out of Tet was mainly booby traps and stuff for the first 30 days I was there.
Okay.
You know, I heard a lot of the stories of the guys that were up at Way and where that came from and, you know, SO plant and the places that they'd been. So, you know, the stories were like I was reading, in the paper before I left. But, you know, when I got there, it's pretty well... At that time, I thought, man, I got here at the right time, but boy, what I was wrong. I think 68 ended up being the worst year of all.
Right. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about the tactics employed by your unit out in the field?
Well, the first part of 68, we're on Hill 190, so our tactics are basically to keep Elephant Valley open there on the river. And the guard, the outskirts of Da Nang, and our job was to run patrols and night ambushes and things there in a certain area outside of Da Nang. And that's all we did for the first about 45 days we were there. After that, they moved us over to Hill 55, and we started running larger sweeps. We'd run platoon size and a company size sweeps and operations. And I think February we participated in one operation, and that really wasn't much to it. The only guys that really got hurt was coming in the wire. Somebody saw a grenade and picked it up. Turned out it was booby trapped, and the guy thought that one of the other Marines had dropped it. And when he picked it up coming into the wire, as the operation ended, a couple guys were killed. But I know in March we were on, I think it was Operation Worth.
Okay.
And we had a couple guys, you know, that were hurt, and so things started picking up. And but between March and May, we ran a lot of series of ambushes and patrols, and really didn't find a lot of anything. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden in May, it seemed like everywhere we went, there was death. Mm-hmm. And in May, we got an operation, Ballard Valley, I think it was, and ran into the enemy. And we fought on that in Allen Brook in May. And, you know, Allen Brook, we lost a lot of guys that were killed and wounded. And I actually had one young guy named Ware. He was a black guy, and he came to me and said that he just knew he was going to die, and he didn't want to go out on this operation where we're going, and never will forget him. And a kid from East St. Louis, and I say kid, I was only about a year older than him, probably. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he only had like 2 weeks, I think, left in country. Mm. And I went to the CO and asked him if we could get Ware out the field early. And he said, no, everybody had to go because we're shorthanded. And we had one of our first experiences over in a place called Happy Valley. And everybody knew when you went there, nobody was going to be happy. Mm-hmm. So we went and we were moving toward a railroad berm, and there was a village on our right and a river on our left, and kind of open area and tall grass. And as we're moving through it, we had three tanks with us, and all of a sudden the tanks started blowing up, and the village started to open up. And I remember Ware was with a 60 mortar group, and I got away from the tank I was close to since it was getting hit. Mm-hmm. And hit the ground, started returning fire, leaving the machine gun team I had with me over. And next thing I know, just where the 60 mortar guys were setting up, they zeroed in on them and dropped their mortars in before our mortars could do anything. Mm-hmm. And I knew that didn't look good. Mm-hmm. Still there?
Yes, sir. I'm listening.
Okay. I lost my earpiece here for a minute.
Okay.
But anyway, I was, you know, busy at that time. We had a guy that was with one of the papers or magazines with us, and a stupid guy thought he would get under the tank, and the tank started getting hit, so the tank moved and ran right over him. And I said, oh my goodness, it's going to be a long day.
Mm-hmm.
And so we couldn't go anywhere, so we had to fight it out until we got some support in on the village. And by then, all the tanks, two of the three tanks had been knocked out, and we had guys laying all over the place, you know, dead or wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so we cleaned the village out and got our people out, and I got over, and I was the first one to wear, and I found him, and he was just, you know, laying on his stomach, and I didn't know what I was going to find when I turned him over. And I turned him over, and it's like there was no blood. There was no nothing. I couldn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to wake him up, and I said, man, I could tell he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, wake up. And anyway, I finally noticed right in the zipper of his flak jacket,
mm-hmm.
there was a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And so I zipped his flak jacket open, and right through his heart,
about
the size of a pin needle, was where a piece of shrapnel went right through his zipper part of his flak jacket, right through his heart, killed him.
Right.
And I said, man, I mean, if it had been to the left or right, you know, a half an inch, he would have been okay. But anyway, you know, it started making me think about, you know, guys talking about they knew they were going to die or something.
Right.
But then the weird thing happened. We cleaned up our area, got our wounded out, and we were told that they were bringing another company out to help us. And they had some tanks with them to replace the two tanks we'd lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a mess getting those guys out of the tanks. But, boy, mess. But anyway, we set up. And as we were set up, we waited a couple hours for this other company and their tanks to come out and join us so we could keep on going toward this railroad berm.
Mm-hmm.
And as they came out, and they got, I guess within about, 100 yards from us, all of a sudden the tanks opened up on us. And a guy named Strobe was standing beside of me, my M79 man, And we were both looking over this little brick wall. And I said, well, I'm going to sit down and rest a little bit longer before they get here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kept watching them. And the next thing I knew, his head was down beside me. And his body just stood there without his head for a minute, and mm-hmm. then it collapsed. And the tank had fired a beehive round, and it just decapitated his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if I hadn't sat down, it'd done the same thing to me.
Right.
And so we lost a couple of guys because they were jumpy when they came out, and the tank just opened up thinking that, you know, we were the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we got that squared away and had to get the dead and wounded out from that, then we moved on out together and stayed out there sweeping the area for a couple of days. Happy Valley is where my unit always hated to go. That was our nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
When we knew we were going there, we knew some of us wasn't coming back.
Right. Was this part of you say this was part of Operation Allenbrook?
I can't remember if that
okay.
was Allenbrook or if that was Ballard Valley. They
okay.
were both about the same time.
Okay. All right. Was this the first major encounter with the enemy?
It was the first major one that I was involved.
Uh-huh.
We'd had some smaller ones where we had lost a couple of guys back on Operation Worth. But
mm-hmm.
That was where the first guy I saw, a guy named Ward, because Ware's the one I just told you about. But
right.
a Mormon from, I think he was from Texas, a corporal named Ward, Brent Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And he was killed one night trying to get to his hole. The goose
mm-hmm.
just threw some rounds at us, and it just hit him before he could run over in his hole and killed him. But
mm-hmm.
But this was the first, you know, big battle I was involved in.
Right.
You know, where a lot of guys were hurt. And you understood what it was to have RPGs and mortars and bullets all coming at you at one time. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, you had to start moving people around the best as you could. You just didn't stand up and run toward the village. So, you know, we had to kind of crawl and move and try to get some artillery and air support in.
Mm-hmm.
But we went on from there and had a lot more of those encounters from then through December. So,
mm-hmm.
But after December, in January and February, it kind of went back to the ambushes and stuff again,
mm-hmm.
booby traps. But between May and December, Echo Company really took a beating.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I imagine we went through 200 or more percentage, you know, the company in casualties. So.
Right. All right. Could we switch gears a minute and talk a little bit about the enemy and your
sure.
your impression of them and their abilities as a fighting force, I guess.
Well, the NVA, I thought, was good and well-trained, and they had been there for many years, and they knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always going to their terrain where they were dug in, you know, it wasn't like they were always coming to us. When they did, they usually got their butt kicked. But
mm-hmm.
It's the same thing as us going to them. We usually got our butt kicked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in most cases, we'd throw out artillery or whatever, but they were so dug in that unless it hit directly on them. But they seemed like they didn't want to die. I mean, they seemed like you could shoot them, you know, a dozen times, and they're still shooting at you. But it was... I just say they were just, you know, well prepared and good at what they did. And I'm
mm-hmm.
sure that some of their newer outfits and a lot of their replacements were like ours. They didn't last long because they weren't so experienced. But
right.
the experienced NVA was a good fighting force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd put it right up there beside ours. They would stick it out, and they would, you know, they wouldn't turn and run until they knew that they needed to get out and they had a way out.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen them do some extraordinary things. It's like,
mm-hmm.
you know, made you wonder how human can you be. But,
right.
You know, I feel like if I got shot, I'd want to sit down and holler and cry. But I guess that's why the Lord never got me shot.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the guys were good in their tactics. They were good in their ambushes. They were good in the villages. how they had set up their villages with booby traps, snipers, machine guns. They had spider hose that you couldn't even see unless you stepped in one. And you know, they had their little punchy traps here or there in certain areas. And if you jumped from an explosion, you might jump into them. And they had all this stuff pretty well thought out. And if you went into their villages and you got hit, you're going to be there for a while. And the only thing that's going to get you out of there is artillery or air support in most cases. It wasn't like a lot of cases where you just got up and could sweep the village. In most cases, you couldn't.
Right.
So I think they were, you know, a good fighting force. Mm-hmm. The Viet Cong, on the other hand, we didn't have a lot of fights with the Viet Cong. Most of ours were the NVA. And most of the Viet Cong we ran into, the villagers and stuff, was, you know, more catching them doing booby traps or as we swept a village. They were caught off guard sometimes and couldn't get out. And we'd find out where they were dug in and little pig pen stalls and things and dig them out. But they didn't like to fight. They would like to throw out a few shots or do a booby trap and, you know, hide.
Mm-hmm.
But NVA would get right in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed like they always knew we were coming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was like in July, we came from the Philippines and just got regrouped with new officers and new men. And our job was to go in by Amtrak's off the ship on, I think it was called Way Island at the time. And the Army was supposed to be blocking on the mainland. And those folks, they knew we were coming. I mean, we got there, we hit that shore like a World War II movie you might see with the Amtrak's coming up in the village in the sand. And
mm-hmm.
we got out and we started sweeping the village, and I never seen so many booby traps laid out in my life. They were everywhere. You could even see a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they knew we were coming and they were ready for us, and the ones that were there, they weren't going anywhere, so they fought it out.
Right.
We lost a lot of good guys that day because they were well prepared.
Mm.
It's like anything, you just can't go in somebody's hometown and pick a fight, you know.
Right.
They got all their buddies and everybody there with them, so, you know, they know what they're going to do to you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they had good equipment, and the AK-47 was really a bad weapon, and if it hits you, it's going to do some harm to you.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lot of RPGs, and their machine gun didn't worry me so much because it was mainly the RPGs and the AK-47s that we would counter a lot of times more than their machine guns. But when we did, you know, they were real effective with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they really, I think, was great, you know, with camouflage and, you know, concealment. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we learned a lot about camouflage and concealment from them while we were over there.
Right. All right. How often would you say would you say going out on a patrol or something, would you come in contact with the enemy?
Well, see, when we went afloat 6 months, we went afloat or 7 months.
Okay.
Really, what that meant was we were on the ship from the Philippines to Vietnam, and in the next 7 months we didn't see the ship, I think, for about 2 days.
Uh-huh.
So it meant that we were always sent to wherever the hot zone was.
Okay.
So the next 6 or 7 months, that's all we did was fight.
Mm.
I mean, we were from one hot zone to another, and we were getting guys replaced almost, you know, weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And when we hit the beach there on Way Island in July, we went from, I think that was called Eager Yankee, and then we went from there to Swift Play, and in between it, Yankee and Swift Play, we lost a lot of guys.
Mm.
Like, say, on August 18th, our whole battalion walked into a buzzsaw. And when we were pinned down that day, I was platoon sergeant that day, and a lieutenant I had got shot immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to take over the platoon. And, you know, the command battalion was sitting on a mountain right behind us, like a large hill, really. Mm-hmm. And you could actually see the people walking around on it back there behind us. But they couldn't get to us because there was mortars dropping behind us. And there was a village in front of us, and like 10-foot berms, and the openings were covered by machine guns and snipers. And we were going down left and right that day. And like I said, we got through about 8 hours later. There were only 41 of us left, the whole company.
Right.
There was one lieutenant, and he had four men with him. Another corporal, I think, had seven men with him, and I think I had right around 20 or something, or 15 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up there were 41 of us. There was one NCO and one officer, and they made us pick up the gear, and we had to do all that after the battle was over with, and then they made us march out.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also so tired we couldn't even handle, you know, even marching out hardly that day.
Right.
But, you know, then they did what they do. They sent in more officers and more men, beefed us back up again, and we had gone from, you know, there. And then after August and in September, we'd be out on Mamaluke Trust and back on Allenbrook. And so September was another bad month for us. And then in October, we got to Talladega Canyon and Maui Peak and lost more guys. And then we kind of had a little quiet in November. And then if I remember, in December, we was on back on Meat River and Daring Endeavor and Sabine Draw, whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
We lost several guys, and I lost a good friend from Tennessee, a staff sergeant who was the platoon commander of 1st Platoon there in December, and about almost went over and shot our company commander at the time. But it was real bad because I felt that he was a reason that we lost four or five guys that day.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, between June and July and December, we were probably one of the hardest hit companies, I imagine, in the Marine Corps.
Mm. Wow.
And if you look at most float battalions that were out there, you'll find the statistics are real high that all of the companies that were, or battalions that were involved on the floats in Vietnam in 68, were probably the hardest hit groups out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why everybody teases me at the reunions. It's like, how in the world did you make it through 68 without getting wounded, you know?
Right.
So.
All right. When you were out on an operation like that where you would take so many casualties, how long would it generally take to get replacements to get the company back up to full strength?
Anywhere from usually about a week, maybe 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, if you got hit real hard like that, the Marine Corps automatically would send what group they had in the Philippines or wherever they were stationing them at the time. They would automatically, instead of filling different slots, different organizations, they would just send what they had to you in one big glut.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one day you might get 10 or 15 guys, you know, report to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, it was just a constant men coming and going. And you never were full size anyway in your companies. You know, most companies that we were running were, you know, usually around 100, 120 guys in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So your tactics and everything you did was more on a limited basis because of the numbers that you really had.
Right. All right. Would most of these replacements be green, or would all of them be green?
Probably 90% of them were green.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of boot camp, and the officers are right out of OCS.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. In an operation where like that, where you took all those casualties and you only had, you said, about 41 guys left. Would there be any downtime in that, or would you continue to operate the same as normal?
Well, when we left, with 41 guys. Mm-hmm. We marched back to our holding area.
Okay.
I know when I got back there, we had like a lot of guys that were, might be in the office area or whatever, and they were automatically assigned to come beef us up. So we might pick up, you know, 10, 12 guys from the rear that was with our company in the rear. Some may be coming back from R&R or some from injuries. And so that would be the first group we would pick up is our own guys who were coming back from wherever they were coming back from.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we would still, you know, have to do like perimeter duty or something wherever we went.
Right.
But generally, we didn't have our own base since we were the float team. We were out in the field all the time, so they would take us back.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd join in maybe another company somewhere and kind of fit in and pull duty and maybe run a patrol or two.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we still stayed constant as we got beefed up.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't go out on any more operations for another week or two. And then we still didn't have time to train, you know, so everybody just jumped in and next operation, you know, you just went into it with all the new guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was one of the tough parts about being in battle was that, you know, it wasn't like the old Marines. You came in there with one guy's company had been together 3 or 4 years, and, you know, you knew what everybody could do. You know, in Vietnam, after the first wave came in, all the rotation started in 13 months. You either left or you left when you were killed or wounded. You were just constantly in a change mode of people coming and going, but you still had to operate. So
right.
It wasn't the best scenario for his training or anything.
Right. All right. Let's see. One thing I wanted to ask you, did you guys ever go on any joint operations or ever work with the South Vietnamese?
We did. Several times. We worked with North Koreans once.
Okay.
And we always just, the North Koreans, we didn't worry so much because they blew out everywhere they went. They just shot up the area.
Mm-hmm.
But with the South Vietnamese, we kind of stayed where we knew where they were all the time, and we kind of watched ourselves with them.
Mm-hmm.
We'd heard so many rumors, and, you know, we just didn't trust them. So.
Right.
They seemed like they get in the battle, though, and very few of them would want to fight. And they kind of always seemed like the area they would want to go into was the safer of the areas. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people knew what was going on, and we were there, I think, mainly to fight their battle for them. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you guys talk about that as far as, I mean, not to put words into your mouth, but you know, we're over here.
Yeah, we talked about it. It's like, you know, why are we here fighting these idiots' wars when they won't come out and fight? And,
right.
You know, if you see them, they usually got more stuff, you know, like Coca-Colas and things than we do. And
mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it seems like they're more supplied with the rear stuff, you know, like drinks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like our food too much, and we sure didn't like theirs. But you know, we were aggravated because a lot of times we'd have to go to help some of these Vietnamese units, and we'd get there, and, you know, they'd say, you know, they were being overrun or whatever, and actually the time you get there, it's like, you're only taking sniper fire or something, you know? It's like,
right.
You'd just be mad that you're risking your life, and they wouldn't risk theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most of the guys were pretty mad about it.
Right.
But there's nothing we could do about it except watch them, and whatever we heard, we were working with them. Our Marine units were pretty good that at least the people up in command would always not try to intermingle us together,
mm-hmm.
that we would have one operational point and they would have another, and we might be a click apart, and we always knew where they were, and they knew where we were. So
mm-hmm.
I think our higher echelon knew what was going on, and they kind of helped protect us out in the field because they didn't trust them either.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But that doesn't, you know, there were some that were good. We'd have some guys that were assigned to us as interpreters and stuff. And the ones that were entrenched with us, one or two guys that we'd usually have with our company, they, you know, they were right at home. I mean, they were part of us, and we protected them, and they fought right beside us. But, you know, that's just a one and two compared to, you know, 100 or 1,000, you know.
Right. Sure. All right. Well, on operations and on patrols, how often would you come in contact with the local civilian population?
Most of the time when we're on operation, we were in what they called a free fire zone, and there wasn't supposed to be any civilians.
Okay.
But generally, you would always come across a few civilians or a village that was out there. They were told, you know, to get out of the area, and they didn't leave because that was their home. But instead of, you know, just coming around and blowing them away, you know, with women and children, you know, you just wouldn't go to do that. So our position was that when we came across civilians that wasn't where they were supposed to be, we would just gather them up and put them in a circle and keep them there under guard until we swept the area. And then as we left, we'd let them go back to what they wanted to do. But, you know, knowing that most of them were kin to the enemy or everything, but, you know, we just wouldn't go around and shoot people, so.
Right, sure.
But there were quite a few, you know, villages and people we'd run into, and we would do that. And,
What was your feeling about their, I guess, their loyalties? Did they seem to be favorable to one side or the other, or were they trying to kind of stay out of things?
I think the ones we ran across, they didn't want no part of us, because they knew that we'd going to come through and tear through their village and look for weapons and, you know, mess up their day. So I don't think they really liked us. You know, the ones that I saw, you know, we were out in the deep bush all the time, so they didn't want us to be there, just like we didn't want to be there. So I think their thing was, you know, just get in, get out, and leave us alone.
Right.
And I think that was the same feeling they had. You know, if they were good, friendly folks, I think they had the same feeling when the NVA came in there. You know, just get in, get out, and leave us alone.
Right.
And they really didn't have anything but their little villages and their little rice fields. And, you know, that's all they had to live on.
Were there times then when you run into friendly villages that were helpful?
Oh yeah, outside of 190, we had several villages that we'd go down and patrol, and the people would come out and, you know, laugh and talk, and they were pretty secure knowing we were right there beside them. You know, there seemed to be nice folks and everything. Not that we could really talk to them, but some of them knew a little English and. They always seemed like they had Coca-Colas out to sell us, and, you know, it's like being in a hot jungle in the middle of a war. Some kid comes and sell you Coke for 50 cents. And,
right.
Where in the world are you getting Coke? We can't even get Coke.
Right.
But anyway, it was the villages toward the bases were more on a friendly atmosphere, but when you get out in the bush, they were more just get in and get out. We don't, you know, we don't want you here. So,
Right. All right. could you talk about the tactics involved with sweeping a village?
Depends on the village. It could be a different. Sometimes we would send in a couple of fire teams just to check out the area. You know, depending on if there are people in a village or not in a village. If there were, the village was empty, then most likely we'd probably just run into some booby traps or something, but you never knew, depending on what area you were in. A lot of times we might get online and start moving in toward a village, and then have another part of us sweep to the left or sweep to the right, kind of come in on a flank. Sometimes you might, depending on the situation, put a unit kind of to the rear in case you ran into something, hoping that they would run into you. but mm-hmm. keep them out of the way of your own fire coming toward you.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the times, you know, when we're sweeping a village, we usually got hit. So we'd mm-hmm. call everything we could get into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they wasn't asking if there were friendlies there or not, because when you got opened up, you just started returning fire.
Right.
And, you know, if you had artillery or air support, that was the first thing you would do. You would call it in if it was heavy fire coming to you,
mm-hmm.
and let them come in and clean the village, then you would move through it. And sometimes it'd still be there, but you know, most of the cases, especially with air, they would come in and pretty well clean the village out.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And again, a lot of it depends if you're in a free fire zone or not. In a free fire zone, you would more likely use air and, you know, your supports. If you were in a village area closer to a base mm-hmm. that was not a free fire zone, then you would probably have to sweep it, and you wouldn't have your extra support or anything, because you wouldn't want to destroy the village and get mm-hmm. the people all mad at you.
Right.
So, you know, it all depends on where you're at, and what type of zone you were in, and what kind of fire you got. If you're getting sniper fire, you'd go clean it out yourself. If mm-hmm. you got heavy machine gun and mortar fire, you'd probably try to blow it away.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, on sweeps where you actually would not come into contact with the enemy, would there, I guess, would you often find things like rice stores and weapons caches and things like that?
It's about 50-50.
Okay.
I'll say sometimes you could go through a village and find really nothing. Sometimes you go through a village and you might find, rice maybe buried in the ground or hidden. You might find a weapon or a grenade or two. Every now and then you might run across a big cache, but most of those were outside of the villages and things. Just, they pretty well knew that, you know, Marines sweeping the villages were liable to find something. So
mm-hmm.
usually they put most of their big caches out in, you know, the areas that were more fortified they could protect. And so, you know, you'd find a few things maybe in the villages. We didn't find, like, in the areas we ran a lot of large caches and unless it was up in the jungles or somewhere.
Okay. All right. If you, I guess if you did find something, but the villagers were peaceful, but if just if you did find something, what would be done with the villagers at that point?
Usually when you went into the village, you still try to gather them if it was
okay.
a small village and keep them because you didn't want any harm to happen to them either. If you open a door and there's a booby trap or something, even they might know it was there, they usually stayed away from it. But
right.
you try to keep them all in one area so you could watch them, because you never knew. You know, a grenade could come out from them or something.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you found, like, weapons or rice or things like that, you would call it in.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, they would just tell you if you wasn't needing to move out or something, just to hang loose, and they'd send out a couple of interpreters if you didn't have any with you.
Mm-hmm.
They'd send out these, I'm not sure what they were called, little squads that the Vietnamese had. And usually they had an American with them, and they would come into the village, and they would take over. Usually we'd go ahead about our business, and we'd leave them with those folks where they kind of went through and interpreted you know, the villagers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time we didn't have a whole lot to do with it. Once we found it, we'd call it in, and that generally sends somebody in. And if it was a free fire zone now, they might tell us to destroy the village.
Mm-hmm.
So we would just burn it.
Right.
And, you know, leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, civilians would be mad at us, but they weren't supposed to be there anyway. But
right.
But if it's in a friendly area, then usually you would call in this other units, and they would kind of come in and do their talking to the people and kind of take over, and we'd move on out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Another thing I wanted to ask you, mentioned, you talked about booby traps being a problem, but could you talk about, I guess, about some of the different kinds of booby traps that the enemy would use?
Sometimes they would have tar grenades.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they would take a grenade and put it in maybe one of our C-ration cans and put the wire on it. And if you hit the wire, it pulled it out of the can and it blew up. Sometimes they had what we call the old Shacom grenades. Looked like a long stick with a little cylinder on the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And those you didn't mind too much because they were about 50%. I would say they would go off, and a lot of them would be duds. But you'd move into the big nasty things like R-60 mortar rounds or their big mortar rounds. Most of the time it was our ammunition that exploded. The worst was the 155 rounds that were duds that they would booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen them take out a whole command almost.
Mm-hmm.
We had one operation where our captain actually set off the booby trap and almost wiped out his whole company command,
mm-hmm.
like 14 guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so mad that day because we're on patrol, and next thing I know, he's taken off with his group to the right of us, and it's like, where in the world is he going? Next thing you know, the largest explosion I could ever imagine went off, and sand was everywhere, and a whole command group was down over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But a 155 was a nasty round for a booby trap. They would also do some of their little wooden spear things, and we didn't run across those a whole lot. We'd run into the little punji traps a lot, but
mm-hmm.
most of their weird stuff we didn't run into but once in a while. And
right.
But most of the stuff we ran into were our own dud rounds, or the old Chi-Coms that they had and their old grenades. And they had those little toe popper things that if you hit, kind of jumped up in the air and went off about your mid-waist and would just about cut you off in half or blow your legs out from under you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a lot of times they'd take our claymores that they would come across and they'd use our own claymores against us and put them in trees and different things. So
mm-hmm.
I would say probably 75% of the booby traps we ran into were either stuff they stole from us or stuff that we left or dropped somewhere and or with dud rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But they were our stuff.
Right.
And I think we were more scared of those booby traps than we were of, you know, our ambushes and things. So.
Right. I know there's no way to know exactly, but about what percentage would you think of casualties were from booby traps?
Well, the when we were set up in the rear, it was 100%. But when we were out in the field, it was probably more like our 10 or 15%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Excuse me. All right. Well, we're coming up on 2 hours here. Would you like to go ahead and stop for today and then pick up at another time?
It's up to you. I've got time here on my side, so
okay.
Whatever you want to do. You got your time schedule.
Right. All right. I think there's a. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Dan Storrs. Today is September 11, 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Storrs is joining me by phone once again from Collierville, Tennessee. Okay, last time when we were talking, a little bit about some of the well, I guess we're talking about the war in a little bit more general terms, but you also talked about this contact with the enemy in the Happy Valley area where you lost a man. Are there other specific or significant contacts with the enemy that you could possibly talk about that you remember?
There are several of them.
Okay.
The biggest one, like I said, I believe was on August the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
When our company walked out with only 41 men left.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably one of the roughest days we ever had. We were pinned down from approximately, I guess, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning to about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon
mm-hmm.
before we could get up and get moving.
Mm-hmm.
And but we lost a lot of guys to snipers and machine gun fire, and was pretty well pinned down until they finally could get some support out to us. But a lot of people were getting hit that day, and we were kind of last on getting some relief. So one of those days we just kind of had to fight it out and not keep our head up too high or get it sniped off.
Right.
I know in December we lost several guys as we were taking up position on a couple small hills, and we had a company on top of the hills. We had two platoons with the company commander on the largest hill, and then I had another platoon. At the time I was acting platoon sergeant, or not acting platoon sergeant, acting platoon commander, and I was breaking in a new staff sergeant. He was supposed to take over the platoon for I could go back to platoon sergeant. And that day the lieutenant sent a squad down into the village down below them, and they were ambushed, and a lot of people were mad, and we had another village at my end of my finger where we had one guy surrender, and we had a lot going on there for about 2 or 3 days. This were kind of a blocking force right there at these villages, and this big rice paddy area down below us where the Army is supposed to be driving people our way. One of the things I recall happening that I was so mad about was we had a sniper team with us, and they kept shooting down toward the wells where the kids were, and I got upset and told the lieutenant that was unnecessary, and he kind of beefed back, you know, that he was a company commander. And so anyway, we kind of got into it, and they finally quit shooting down that way. But the next day is when the squad went down there, and a good friend of mine was killed, and I was pretty upset at him about doing something that stupid. But anyway, that's the kind of way things were over there. Most times a lot of officers would come in and listen to their sergeants. A lot of times they'd come in and still be in the John Wayne mode, so you just kind of had to work around it the best you could.
Was speaking of that relationship between the sergeant and the lieutenant, would it at times, if the lieutenant came in there, you know, immediately thinking, as you mentioned, in the John Wayne attitude, thinking that he knew everything, and you being the sergeant that had the experience already, would it take a while for him, I guess, to realize that he needs to listen to his sergeant? Because I know from a lot of veterans that I've interviewed, and from a lot of what I've read, has said that, you know, that the experience of the sergeant is what really held the unit together.
Oh yeah, I agree. It's like the lieutenants I have that are still left, they kind of say that I was kind of the glue whenever we get together. But anyway, some of them would listen, And they learned. They still made some mistakes, but they were more free thinking and knew not just to charge somebody when bullets started flying, unless they knew where the enemy was. But but some of them, if they'd been out of OCS and this was their first duty station outside OCS, their mentality was to always charge and flank, and you know, you just couldn't do that. 90% of the occasions over there, due to the terrain and where you were, without getting people killed. And you tried to drive it into them, you know, not to look for medals, but try to protect your men. And if you could, call in artillery and air support first and then go in. But, you know, they sometimes had a hard time. They just wanted to get up and go get the guys, not knowing how many were there, if it was a trap trying to lure you in. But they made one mistake, though. They learned by it real quick if they're still alive.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. You mentioned artillery and airstrikes. How vital were they to your operations? How significant and how important were they?
Well, if it wasn't for the artillery and the air support, I don't think it'd be too many Marines left standing that were out there in the infantry, because we were always calling them in for support, especially on any big operation where we're going against a large number of enemy, or if we had a field where they were pretty well dug in and they weren't going to flinch. And it's their territory, especially Happy Valley, you'd have to call in air support. But a lot of times, some of us Marines, we got out too far where we were and we didn't have artillery support. And when that happened, the only thing we could do was wait until we could get some air support. And sometimes that was too long in waiting. There's a lot of things going on in country, and sometimes the officers would just say, we got to do it. And that's when usually a lot of people got hurt.
All right. I wanted to ask you a question about the way the enemy operated. I know in the book We Were Soldiers, it talks about how because the enemy realized that that American air power and artillery was overwhelming, that they would try to get in close and try to grab on basically to the belt loops of the Americans to prevent them from using artillery and airstrike. Did you find that that was the case with the NVA?
Not in our case.
Okay.
We didn't let them get that close.
Uh-huh.
Usually when we made contact, we knew where they were and where we were, and if we could call in, we would. If we couldn't, we would hold our position. And a lot of times in that movie, they were kind of moving out closer to the enemy or got themselves separated.
Mm-hmm.
And we never tried to get ourselves in a jam or we'd get separated. Now, a lot of outfits did, but mm-hmm. we tried to work as a unit. And if we knew we were in bad man's territory like Happy Valley, we didn't have a platoon going one way and another one going another way, because we knew that they'd both probably get hit and neither one of them could help each other.
Right.
Our motto was basically, you know, if we got hit, as soon as we could call in the support, we'd call it in, but we'd keep the enemy away from us also, because we had our little M79 launchers, and you know, we had some bazooka rocket teams with us usually.
Mm-hmm.
And if we set up the machine guns right, you know, they wouldn't go get that close to us. And a lot of our terrain also was rice paddies, and a lot of it was up in the mountains in the jungle. So you know, a lot of times you just fought where you were, and they didn't expose themselves, and we didn't expose ourselves too much. So we just put the fire down toward them, they put it down toward us.
Right. Yes, sir.
I could understand in that movie, you know, and how they were talking, because they were basically encircled, and they had the enemy going in, you know, at them in different directions all the time, keeping them off guard. But the terrain where they were kind of allowed that to happen. So,
Right. All right. Was the Happy Valley, would you say that was the hottest area that you guys operated in?
Or oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right. Was that, I'm trying to remember, is that anywhere near the Arizona territory? Did you guys operate there too, or was that?
Yeah, we did. And it was out there in that same direction. It was all basically enemy territory.
Mm-hmm.
You went there, there was no good guys. So
mm-hmm.
once you crossed the bridge and moved down alongside the river toward the railroad berm, down there, the railroad berm, villages are on that side, and that area were all unfriendly. So you just, that's why you know, they called it Happy Valley. You knew you wasn't going to be happy when you got the word you were going there.
Right.
And I can't remember the name of that bridge, but there's a big bridge that you had to kind of cross the river over to get to Happy Valley. And generally, when we went there, we went by foot because they had lost too many choppers in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. One other question about the way the enemy operated. I know in the case of the VC, they would often run soon after contact was made. Did you find that the NVA would basically stand and fight?
Well, the NVA that we ran across, they would stay and fight as long as they could. Once they knew that the artillery and air support was coming, a lot of times they would boogie out and try to get out of there. Unless they were in some deep fortified positions, then they would just, you know, hold out and make it look like that the air or the artillery had done its job, and then they'd hopefully you'd move back into their ambush again.
Mm-hmm.
But they were well trained. I mean, most of the time they would hit you, and they knew if they stayed that the odds are they were going to get hurt. So they were pretty well organized. And except that day on August 18th when they stayed involved. But most of the time they would hit you, and they would pull out and just leave a couple guys as a rear guard that would pop some rounds at you, kind of keep your head down.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, if you're taking casualties, you didn't really pursue them so much as putting the perimeter up to get your casualties out. So they had double chance to get away in most cases.
Okay. All right. You talked about the fortified positions and bunkers and things like that. Could you talk a little bit more about that, about how, I guess, how they use the environment to their advantage and the use of bunkers and things like that?
Well, most of their bunkers, you could walk almost right up onto them and not even see them. They were so well camouflaged. But they used a lot of anthills so well that you started getting leery of just being around an anthill or a termite hill. And but they would take and hollow them out and put their machine gun in there, and usually they'd have two or three men in there, and they could have them in two or three termite mounds across, you know, an area. And it was almost like they were put there. I know they couldn't be, but it's almost like, you know, they were put there. Up in the jungles, man, you could walk right on top of those things and not see them the way they have them camouflaged along the trails and the Turner trails and kind of up high, enveloping where you were down low. And, you know, when that machine gun started battling off, and you couldn't see it, you know they were usually down in a bunker somewhere, and it was going to be hard to blow them out of there. And generally, that's what you had to do. You had a lot of places in the jungle, you couldn't call in artillery or air support because you could get hurt with all the fragmentation yourself. So a lot of times we had to go in there and just find them and you know, try to kill them if they were still there with grenades. But they were really good at concealing themselves, the camouflage. I know when we came back from the Philippines and we hit Way Island, a lot of them had put their booby traps and things out all over the island, but they had knew that the army was on the mainland and they couldn't escape. So they had all these places dug into the pig pen areas and the mounds and things. And we couldn't find them, and finally we had a Korean with us, interpreter, and he started interrogating some villagers, and he found out that they were buried all around the island, and they looked for little pieces of bamboo sticking out of the ground. It was an air hoe. And we started looking around, and we found all kind of air hoes, especially around some of the small dikes leading around the places where they'd keep their pigs and their little animals and livestock. And as we, you know, started trying to dig them out, everything, we would start where the air hoe was, the bamboo, if we couldn't find where their main chute was. And we start trying to very carefully dig around that, drop a smoke grenade in or a concussion grenade in. I know in one case we dropped in a smoke grenade, we dropped in a concussion grenade, and finally, another great grenade, one of our grenades, came back out to the hoe at us, and we all ducked for cover. And we threw two more grenades in there, and when we were through, it turned out there were three NVA in the hoe, and they were stacked almost on top of each other, and this one guy was taking the blunt of all the grenades and everything. And the other two were kind of piecemeal, but one of them was still alive, and the other one, other two were dead. But the guy on the bottom was still alive after all that. He was just shaking up. But, I mean, they hit. And I guess what bothered most of us is they always seemed like they knew where we were and where we were coming. And on this particular operation, they undoubtedly knew we were coming with all the booby traps they had put out there. So a lot of guys got blown up with booby traps, because I remember that day, because I was the last one out of the field with malaria that particular night. But we'd already got our dead and wounded out of there before I fell sick.
All right. Lynn, could you talk about, excuse me, did you guys operate a good bit at night as well? I mean, could you talk a little bit about that, if so, and how night operations be different?
Yeah, at nighttime, when we're out in the field, generally we would have an observation point, an op or two, out a little bit in front of our lines, just as a warning.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, depending on where we were, we might have one or two ambushes sent out.
Okay.
And generally, whenever an ambush went out, we would usually send almost a squad in most cases. And generally, we would send a fire team out on the op. But when the squad went out, generally, either the platoon commander, in most cases, the platoon sergeant or right guide would always go out with that squad. So generally, about every second or third ambush, I'd go out with the squad leader, just in case they hit something if we were in bad territory. And every now and then we would catch somebody, you know, in the ambush. But most of the time, you know, we wouldn't see anybody. A lot of times the little ops group that was smaller would hear them moving around or something and, you know, let everybody know. But just very seldom I remember, you know, that we would catch a couple people in an ambush, you know, at nighttime. Generally, a lot of times we're using our night scope, and we would see them moving around and then open up when if they were coming toward us or put some fire out if they were going away from us.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty good. NDA didn't just walk into a lot of ambushes when they knew you were in the area. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, just how an ambush would work? And how you would set it up?
Yeah, most of the time when I was out with the squad, most of the squad leaders would set an ambush up. First, we'd go out, and as it was getting dark, we would pick out a point where we were supposed to set up. And we'd let the enemy usually see us kind of setting up in a little area.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as it got dark, we'd pick up and move back to the point where we really wanted to set our ambush up, just in case somebody was watching.
Mm-hmm.
They might throw mortars in on us at the other position if they happen to see us.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, just as precaution, we would move back to where we were going to have our original site.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the terrain, a lot of times you would have a guy down a little bit from the main group, just kind of watching. And you have another one at the other end kind of watching the trail. And you'd either have a piece of string or they would have a radio, and they would let you know real quietly somebody was coming up the trail. If you had some string and you went too far out, you just pull on the string, and everybody kind of knew what was going on if they did that. A lot of times, like I said, dictating on the type of trail it was, you'd either be laid out in a line, or sometimes you would, if you have a bend, you would kind of be almost like an L shape in a way, but
okay,
where all your fire would go either straight, or say if you're lined up down a left line, kind of bending to your right, you knew that you feel the fire is either just straight, and you'd put your little something in the ground to keep from shooting your own guys back to the left. But most of the time, we didn't get into too many L shapes. Most of the time, we'd get into just being in line and just kind of having a guy on our backside watching to make sure nobody came up from the rear on us. So that's pretty well how most of them worked. And then most people would try to keep half your guys awake all the time. And that was hard to do sometimes when you're out all the time, only got your 2, 3, 4 hours sleep every night. But everybody was pretty well, you know, well aware of what would happen to you if you'd fell asleep on your watch. So
right,
really about half of us stayed awake on an ambush, and the other half are right there beside where we can wake them up real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And then you knew the guys that might make noise or, you know, you had, usually if you had someone that made a lot of racket in the field on the ambush, and you know, I would stay close to them, or squad leader or someone, just to make sure that they were quiet. You have a lot of noise when guys go to sleep, that's for sure.
Right. All right.
If you're in real bad territory, nobody went to sleep. You're out in Happy Valley like that, everybody stayed awake all night long. So, and that was tough to do. You had to get your mind thinking about other things and try to have a pretty good positive attitude about getting home or girlfriends or cars or something like that, just to get your mind working to keep you, you know, not falling asleep.
All right. When you wouldn't be out on an ambush at night, what would you be doing? What would the rest of the company be if the guys that were not set up in an ambush?
If they wasn't on the ambush, if we were out in the field, they'd be setting up a perimeter.
Okay.
And generally, we would have a 360 set up, and I would be kind of in the middle of that 360, and generally it'd be me and the lieutenant and the corpsman and radio team. Then we would make sure, depending on the terrain, you know, where our guys were setting up around us, because we always had to go out and make sure they were awake, you know, on our night watch. And so they would set up, you know, a 360, and we'd have the machine gun set up in the areas we would think that's where I would come from if I was a gooks. And then the men generally were in three-man hose. And if they were, then one guy stayed awake and two slept. They were in two-man hose, and one stayed awake and one slept. They'd usually do that either in a two-hour period or a four-hour or a three-hour period. It's generally 6 hours was the most, from 12 to 6 that anybody got to sleep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Would the enemy ever hit these positions at night?
Oh, yeah. We had several times when they would try to come in. Sometimes we had them where they'd even try to go out, where they were buried somewhere in our circle, our perimeter, and they'd try to sneak out at night. We'd catch them every now and then. But, the worst area you're in, the more you're liable to get hit. And so, whoever was awake, it was for him to stay awake. But a lot of times we'd get word that we were going to get hit, and everybody stayed awake, and whether we got hit or not. So we were 100% operational.
Right.
But, most of the time we tried to get somebody to get at least 2 hours, 3 hours sleep, you know, every night anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In the daytime you were marching or filling sandbags, or you were busy all day long, you couldn't sleep during the day, so you had to get what sleep you could.
All right. Well, I know one of the common, cliches or sayings of the war is that we own the day and Charlie owns the night. Did you find that there was any truth to that? Were the enemy more active at night than the day, or did it matter really where
no,
you?
No, okay. I don't think it mattered. Mm-hmm. Charlie owned Charlie's territory, period,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't matter if it was day or night. If you were out in Happy Valley or somewhere, you didn't own anything.
Mm-hmm.
You were, you know, hoping that the clothes you had on you, that you were going to get back with those clothes.
Right.
But we got hit, I would say, as far as big operations, we got hit more in the daytime. At nighttime, generally, we would get mortared. Mm-hmm. And that happened on most nights when you're out in a bad man's territory. So in the daytime, you fought off the snipers, machine guns, or ambushes, and booby traps. And at nighttime, you usually had to have a hole dug in. And that's one thing. See, once you set in, you had to dig a hole, no matter who you were.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped to make you tired also. So the time you get your 2-3 hours sleep, you're ready to go.
Right.
But, we'd usually get mortared quite often at nighttime. We lost a lot of guys, you know, with mortars and things.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw one of my guys who was a platoon sergeant in another platoon there in our company at our last reunion, and the first time I'd seen him in 40 years. And I remember him getting hit in December by a mortar round while we were setting up. I remember him leaving and saying, "Sergeant Story, I got my wound and I'm going home."
Right.
I wanted to shoot him.
Right. When a guy would be hit and medevaced out, would you hear from again? Would you hear about their condition and what happened to them?
Most of the time, no.
Okay.
Most of the time, if it was real bad, they were taken back, their rear, and then off to Japan or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't too bad of a wound, then we would see them back in the field.
Okay.
But most of the cases, the guys we had, you could pretty well tell if they were going to make it or not. And a lot of guys with the gut wounds, we knew, even though they'd been picked up and they were alive, most likely they wouldn't go to make it, and they didn't. Only one guy surprised me. I had a guy named Troy Dyer, and he had a booby trap and lost both his legs. And he was bleeding pretty hard, and the corpsman worked on him, and we got a chopper in pretty quick and got him out of there. And I really didn't think he would make it. And then the first reunion we had down in Jacksonville, I guess about 12, 14 years ago, he showed up in his wheelchair. And he still had that little boyish look as he did when he was in Vietnam. And
right.
He said he made the most of his life.
Mm-hmm. Would that be the case sometimes if a guy was hit pretty bad, you wouldn't find out his fate until, I guess, years later?
In most cases, generally that's right, especially if something happened to him, like after he got to Japan or somewhere. If he usually was back in our battalion aid station or where they would take him to clean him up, if they didn't, a lot of times they might take him out to an aircraft carrier and we'd never hear from him. But if he was somewhere back in our rear, then usually we'd get the word, you know, that they patched him up and they think he's going to be okay, or, you know, they're giving the odds at 50-50 or, you know. But that was usually the only time we'd really know what happened to them if they were back in our rear somewhere. But usually if they hit an aircraft carrier or was sent back to one of the big medevac areas where the bad wounds went, and unless he died on the operating table at the very rear, we wouldn't hear anything about him.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of guys we know that are out there that we still don't know what happened to them, you know, when they get back home.
Right.
We can tell the ones that are dead because we can go on the wall and find their names.
Sure.
Which, you know, we found, I think we had 39 that were killed in 68. Mm. We had 88 in the company that were killed from 65 to 70. So we know who those folks are.
Right.
But we didn't until, you know, we had the wall to go to, and electronically we could pull in and look at things real easy and throw in names and see what happened.
Right. All right. Going back just a moment, talking about night operations and things like that, one of the things I wanted to ask you there, you mentioned getting 2 to 3 hours sleep a night at most. How did that affect, I guess, did you get used to that over time? I mean, how did that affect you just being able to physically operate, only getting 2 to 3 hours sleep a night?
You got used to it.
Right.
I mean, after a while, it's like, you know, working a late shift or something. You get used to it, but it doesn't mean you like it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the first few months when we was on Hill 190, you know, guys could get some rest. They'd get at least 4 or 5 hours sleep. But once we hit the afloat thing, and we were out in the field all the time, very seldom did we get any rest. And that's like I said, when we had Christmas in 68, and Bob Hope was there for the USO show, and they pulled us back in. They brought us all into a hangar in Da Nang, and they had cots all in this hangar. And we had all these guys go see the USO show, and I don't know where they had their energy. And I told them, go ahead, I wasn't going. And I laid down on a cot, and I slept all day. I was so tired.
Right. Well, that brings up another question. When you weren't out on operation, how would you spend your free time? Mostly sleeping?
No.
Okay.
In the daytime, you were still running patrols and ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the guys, we're either fortifying their position where we're going to be for that night, or they were doing something like digging, hose for people to use the bathroom and stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something going on.
Mm-hmm.
If we were in Bad Man's territory, we stayed busy. I mean, if we were in some place like Elephant Valley, then we wouldn't so much on the guard, or we could take a little bit more leisure for us. Maybe having a couple of guys say, "Hey, take one of your fire teams and let them go shut out during the day for a couple hours or something," or just tell them to relax. You know that they don't have any guard duty or anything today.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, everybody was busy, though, and it was so hot, it was hard to sleep anyway, so,
right.
Not like you had a lot of cover or anything.
Mm-hmm. All right. Were there times, though, whenever you would be pulled out of the field back at a base camp, or was it always out in the field?
No, the 6 months we were afloat, we were always out in the
field.
And we went from one hot spot to another. Usually they would pick us up by chopper and take us over to another place, and we would hit those. And that's why we had, 13 operations there in 68, because we were always on the move somewhere. Once we left 190, in March or April 68, we never had a base again, not until, about the time I was getting ready to leave in February 69, they were pulling them back, and they were taking them off float, and they were going to give them a perimeter to guard. So from February on in 69, those guys didn't have as much going on, but, they were pulled out in 70. So they were only there about another 10 months or so after I left.
Okay. All right. That time period when you were afloat, what was the area of operations? Was it sounds like a broad part of I Corps? Was it?
It was any place they needed us.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. If anybody got hit hard, they sent us in. If they saw a buildup somewhere, they'd send us in to investigate. Our job was to be on the offensive all the time, and so that's all we did was sweep and pull operations.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did you ever operate up close to the DMZ area?
We didn't get too close up there.
Okay.
Most of the time, I forget what Marines were up that way, but we were more around Da Nang and around up toward Way a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. One other thing I wanted to ask you about I guess operations, and you talked about how a lot of times it seemed like, particularly when you'd go out to a really bad area, how the enemy always seemed to know where you guys were and where you were going. I know you may not know this, but how do you think that they were that good with their intelligence that they just knew so much about where you guys were going to be?
Well, I think they had eyes as high as you could go in the South Vietnamese,
Okay.
I mean, it was pretty plain for, anybody to see, because all of a sudden you pulled out of an area at the last minute and you're sent into another area, and it's almost exactly they know what you're going to do. And they had to have eyes and people, but, over there it's pretty easy for them to do it because they would threaten people's families and, they would kill people and their families if people didn't do what they told them. So
right.
I'm sure there was a lot of people on the take over there. But,
All right. Excuse me. All right. Let's see. Before we move on, I know you mentioned that several of these operations. Do any of these in any other operations, I guess, other than the ones you've already talked about, kind of stick out in your mind, some of these specific operations and that you could talk about possibly?
Well, like I said, the big one was August 18th,
uh-huh.
We talked about. Then we had a big one in December. And I'm not sure what month, if it was more, maybe October-ish, probably. It's supposed to be one of the biggest airborne assaults of the war. And our whole battalion was going to be choppered in. And we talked about it roughly. That was the day I got shot down. And that one little machine gun team canceled out the whole operations of all those choppers and all the people there in the air because we got shot down. And I thought that was so amazing to me that one machine gun team took out one chopper, and it caused all those other choppers for a whole battalion to turn around and pull back.
Mm.
And that's always amazed me.
Right.
Another thing amazed me on August 18th was the night before, on August 17th, our whole battalion was sitting on this hill right above the area, which was about 400 or 500 yards away. And they had our platoon go down that night into the village. And we pulled out that night, and we were all like, you got to be kidding me. And it was so dark, we had to have a hand on just about everybody's shoulder. And we pulled out, and the platoon went down. We had Lieutenant Toya was our platoon leader, and we just picked up in the Philippines. And we went down into that village, actually got into the village, and the next thing, we heard a couple shots at the front. The word was, turn around and go straight back where we came from.
Mm.
And I often wondered, you know, if that was a setup or, you know, what had happened, because I never could get any real answers from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered what happened if we had gone ahead on that patrol, went through the village and got on the other side, what would happen that next day.
Mm-hmm.
If we would have been surrounded and all killed in the platoon, or if maybe they wouldn't have set up and ambushed the whole battalion, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings back thoughts, you know, what if and when. So.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Well, were there, I know you mentioned, you talked about Happy Valley and how you just kind of knew that you were going to run into something there. But were there other times when you just knew that that there was going to be some kind of contact with the enemy? And if so, I guess what kind of intelligence would kind of give you that idea that the enemy is going to try to do something?
Usually before we would go out on an operation, we would get our marching orders,
mm-hmm.
and they would call us to the company CP, and that would be usually the platoon sergeant and platoon commander. So we would go in there, and the captain, most of the time, sometimes his XO would lay out what we're fixed to do and what order we'd march out. But generally, they would tell us that intelligence says that there's certain regiment or outfit that's in the area, and every now and then they would tell us that, you know, they might expect 50-60% casualties.
Mm.
And it's like they would tell you, you know, this is just between us, you know, not to tell the men.
Right.
So I used to kind of hate that, you know, not being able to tell these guys that, you know, they're telling us that one out of two of us might not be coming back.
Mm.
But,
right.
But anyway, most of the time, if it was Happy Valley, the guys didn't need to know. They understood that they were fixed to run into something.
Right. All right. Do you remember some of the specific NVA units that you guys were operating against?
I had some written down somewhere, but I don't remember offhand
okay.
who they were. I know after the war and through the years, they pretty well said what those units were, but I can't recall them off my head.
Uh-huh. All right. Okay. Let's see. Well, is there, along these lines of we're talking about with the combat, is there anything else we should cover here before moving on to other things?
Not really. Most of 68 with our outfit was basically being in hot zones all the time and people being killed and wounded and new people coming in and taking their place. And
mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, nobody really wanted to know anybody. And, you know, you just did your duty and protected your buddy, and hopefully you made it home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
lot of casualties, though.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, excuse me. Moving on to other things, then. Did you get a chance to go on R&R during your tour?
Yeah, I went to Hawaii.
Okay. All right. And how long was your R&R?
I can't remember. It's either 6 or 7 days.
Okay. All right.
I remember being taken out of the field. I'd been there 10 months when I finally got R&R because they didn't want me to leave being a platoon sergeant.
Right.
And so finally when I got it, it was during a monsoon. It was raining. And anyway, they came and told me I was going out. So I got back to the rear, changed clothes, and went to Da Nang. And I got to Da Nang. They didn't even know I was coming. They didn't have a billet for me.
Huh.
But it turned out that the gentleman that ran the R&R center was somebody I'd served with before in Marine Barracks. And he'd been wounded and been put in that place. So he said, you know, you stay with me tonight, and I'll get you out tomorrow for sure if I have to bump a general. So anyway, we hung out that night. And the weird thing was that night we started talking about one guy. And it's the only night I can ever remember being in Da Nang. And we're out walking around, and we're kind of out in a safety area of the city. Mm-hmm. And just had something to eat. And we started talking about this one guy, and all of a sudden, we looked across and he said, it can't be. And it was this guy we was talking about.
Right.
And so we hollered at him, and we started talking and went over to Sergeant Hoke's little hooch. And we just all had a blast that night. And he was fixed to go on R&R also to Bangkok.
Uh-huh.
And so it was just kind of a weird situation.
Right.
And the next day, he got me on a chopper, not a chopper, but a plane, and got me out.
Uh-huh.
So.
All right. Okay. Well, as your tour was coming to an end, being the sergeant that you were, did your replacement, the guy that took your place, did you meet him? I mean, was he promoted from within, or did
no.
they? Okay.
He was a 16-year veteran in the Marine Corps. He was a staff sergeant. He'd never been in combat or Vietnam before.
Mm-hmm.
He came from Hollywood. He was a recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
And he got there, and bless his heart, he was scared as he could be.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody can understand that.
Sure.
And my role was to, on paper, I was the platoon sergeant, but tactically, I was the platoon commander.
Okay.
Until he understood what he could do. And the CO told me that, you know, Dan, you're in charge until you feel this guy's ready. And then you give it to him and move down to platoon sergeant. And he told his staff sergeant at the same time, you know, that you listen to what he's got to say, you know. And actually, this guy came in toward the end of December, well, probably the 1st of January. So I had about 30 days to help train him before I left.
Mm-hmm. All right. What, if you can remember, what kind of advice did you give him? What kind of things did you tell him to prepare him?
Well, I told him that he needed to listen to the guy that was taking my place who had been around for a while. And this was his second tour. And, you know, he had somebody he could listen to. His squad leaders, he need to make sure he talked to them, that when he was given a marching order, that he actually sat down with his people and, you know, his squad leaders and his platoon sergeant, and they talked about it. And he rotated people, not keeping one person or one group on the front or the rear all the time, but make sure he kept people rotated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he didn't get gung-ho. You know, things happened. Make sure he figured out what was going on and then try to, you know, work through it and manage the plan, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was, from what I understand, he was killed a couple months later after I left.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. That brings up one other question I wanted to ask you. I've also heard that a lot of guys were, I guess, killed soon after after getting there. Did you find that that was the case, that if you survived the first few months, that your chances were better of making it through?
Not with us, it wasn't.
Okay.
You know, generally, a lot of the new guys would make the mistakes. A lot of times they would be put on point and things. They just didn't listen as good as they could, or they didn't smell, or, you know, they had their mind elsewhere when they came over there from home, still thinking about their girlfriends and blaming somebody for being there. Most of the time, blame themselves. But anyway, we lost a lot of guys probably in the first 90 days. But even if your odds were that you had made it past that, like I say, when you look at something that happens on August 18th and there's only 41 of you left, and then by December there's probably 12 of us, and in time I rotated there was just a handful, you know, odds weren't very good, especially in the Marine infantry outfits, period.
Right. All right. Well, as your tour came to an end, was there, what was out processing like? What was leaving Vietnam like for you?
About a week before I was supposed to rotate home, the company commander pulled me to the rear. Our outfit was supposed to go over to Liberty Bridge and pull guard duty there for about a week or so. And he told me I didn't have to go, so I gave my stuff, turned it in, and I kept my pistol until the last minute. But I turned in a lot of my stuff, and I kind of stayed in the rear while the company moved out. And the gunny came over to me and told me he was putting me in for another medal and said he appreciated everything. He probably wouldn't see me again, and he left. And about 2 days before I was supposed to rotate home, we had a new lieutenant, and he came over to me, and he had just come in to the company. He was supposed to go out. And before he did, they were going to make him paymaster. Mm-hmm. So it was payday, and end of January. And so he was supposed to go out to the company, which meant he was going to take a Jeep out there. Well, there were very few guys in the rear, and he came over to me and another guy and told us that we were going to pull guard duty and go out there with him. I said, "You got to be kidding me. I already turned my rifle in, and I just had my 45. And he said, "Well, now go check out a pistol." And I said, "You don't understand. I've been out here 13 months. You don't even know what I've seen."
Right.
And it didn't matter. He was just an ignorant prick. But,
right.
You know, I just wanted to pull him to the side and beat the crap out of him. But
sure.
Anyway, last minute I said, "Okay, I'll go." And, you know, I've heard of too many stories to people a couple of days left not making it.
Right.
So, anyway, that whole way out there on that Jeep, I was just like nervous as I could be, probably as nervous as I ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got out there and everybody was surprised, you know, I was out there, and so I talked and stayed the night, and next day took the Jeep back in.
Mm-hmm.
And that lieutenant, he stayed there and took over his platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt for him, actually.
Sure.
And, anyway, I came back, and this captain was kind of mad at what the lieutenant had done, and he hadn't known about it. And anyway, he told me when I got out there to the bridge to go ahead and turn my weapon in and tell the gunny, not the gunny, but the first sergeant back at the company, ran the company, for me to go ahead and process over to the main. So when I got back and talked to him, he already had the papers, and he said, "Here's 24-hour pass, so basically go to Da Nang, you know, a day early and hide out and whatever you want to do and get your flight and go home."
Right.
So, you know, I told them all goodbye and, you know, kind of felt guilty for leaving and you know, felt guilty for many, many years after that, you know, like even though I'd done my duty and everything, you know, just leaving my men, you
sure.
know, being alive and not really wounded. I got, you know, some things I could have turned in for Purple Hearts and some scars and things like that. But, you know, being a tough platoon sergeant, it's like, you know, I don't need to do any of that.
Right.
Care less about medals. So,
sure.
Got my plane. And the weird thing about flying out is the day I reported in, over there. They had us go out to the plane. We got in line, and they started counting off. And I had my two guys that were with me that were going home also. And I had them in front of me. I said, y'all guys get in front. And being a good platoon sergeant as I was. And, you know, they counted off everybody. When they came to me, they said, well, we got too many people here. And I had to stay another night in Da Nang.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, man, you know, first you send me out on guard duty, and now I got to stay another night here.
Right.
And I said, you guys want to change? And they just looked at me and said, bye, Sarge.
Right. Right.
So, anyway, I stayed there the next night. And there was a lot of weird things going on back here, people getting robbed and craziness going on back in the rear. So I stayed awake just about all night just kind of watching what was going on. And next morning I got that first flight out, and I was gone.
Mm-hmm. All right. After you got back home, did you hear from any of the guys from the unit anymore?
Never did.
Okay.
I was my 4 years was up in 2 months, and they said if you wasn't going to stay in, they had offered me a chance to go to OCS. They offered me a chance to go to either recruiting or drill instructor if I didn't want to be an officer.
Uh-huh.
But every officer told me in 6 months I'd be back to Vietnam. Mm. So I said, I'm not going back to Vietnam, period.
Right.
So I went ahead and took an early out, and so they discharged me 2 months early. And after being a week there in Pendleton, they gave me my papers, and I left to go home.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I didn't see or hear from another person until about 16 years ago.
Okay. All right. Excuse me.
That's all right, me too.
What type of reception did you receive? Did you have any trouble in the airports or anything like that, or?
Well, when we first came back, we flew into El Toro.
Okay.
So, you know, if I remember right, they had a little band there, you know, playing. And but it was real simple. We just got off and walked where they told us to go, and had some buses lined up. And it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like family or, you know, anybody except for the little band sitting there playing.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, we got on our buses. Went over to a Pendleton, and then they started picking on us and making us, you know, walk around picking up paper and butts and anything they could, and, you know, made us all feel like, you know, we just came back from Vietnam, here we are picking up trash again.
Right.
You know? So, anyway, I was glad I made the right decision and went ahead. I love Marine Corps, and if it hadn't been for what happened in Vietnam, I'd probably stayed in, but I just couldn't see that I would make it back a second time if I went. So.
Sure. All right. What was it? What was
it? When you talk about airports, I mean, uh-huh. They had told us pretty well, don't wear your uniforms, you know, when you go home.
Okay.
There's too much going on there in L.A. at the airport, and, you know, people going through there and stuff. So.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of guys had the short hair, so it was kind of pretty noticeable anyway.
Uh-huh. Right. All right. What was it like, I guess, just being back home after coming from a war zone? Was there a transition period?
Yeah. It took the body a while.
Okay.
And it took the mind a while. I remember one time pulling up. I had a convertible, and I pulled up beside this church, and there's a little bus seat right there in front of it where you could sit and wait for the bus to come.
Okay.
Some kid was on the other side of it with a cap gun and popped it a couple of times. Not about went flying out of that car. But,
right.
You know, most of the time I was pretty well laid back anyway. So I started trying to relax, and it was just hard to relax. It was hard to sleep. It was hard to get back in. And I still, in the same way today, I still, you know, about every 2 hours when I go to sleep, I wake up and get up, walk around, look around, or I don't sleep real comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And unless I'm just totally exhausted. But, yeah, it was a challenge, but I got lucky. I came back. I found a job and stayed in that job for almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm. What was the job, if you don't mind me asking?
It was with the phone company.
Okay.
I came in, and they were looking for people with their military behind them. And, actually, it was South Central Bell at the time.
Okay.
And I went with a friend. He was looking for a part-time job. And while I was there, the lady said, "Don't I know you?" It turned out a girl I graduated from high school with.
Huh.
She asked me what I was doing. I told her I just got out of the Marine Corps, and she said, "Well, would you like to come back and apply for a job?" I said, "Well, sure." I didn't even know what they did.
Right.
I went back there and applied for the job. I got it, and my buddy didn't.
Right.
So I ended up putting telephones in. Then I went on into management about 7 years later. Was a design person, a salesperson, and I retired in 2001 as a project manager, and I've been working contract and work back to them ever since 2001 whenever I want to work as a project manager. But to me, it always like my combat training and stuff. Most of the time, I was kind of making my own decisions and kind of in charge of my own, you know, day. I had my marching orders, and I went out and took the objective and then came back. But
right.
I get to go home and eat. Feel safe.
Right. All right. My dad worked for South Central Bell for about 30 years.
Did he?
Yeah.
Where at?
Down in Mobile, Alabama.
Really?
Yep. Yep. He ran one of the central offices. Well, not one
okay.
of the. I guess it was a central office. He worked
the
there.
Yeah, one of the frames down there?
Uh huh. Yes, sir. Okay. Yep. Work, told me he worked by himself, basically like working in a cave for 30 years.
Yeah, it is. We used to go in there sometimes and talk to some of the guys, but I worked up my whole tour out of Memphis, and here in the last 4 years, I've actually moved down to Florence, Alabama.
Okay.
So I love it down here. So that's where I'm at really right now is Florence, Alabama.
All right. Well, before wrapping up the interview, I guess the last thing we should do, if you wouldn't mind if I ask some general questions about your opinion on the war and the way it was handled and
sure.
that type of thing. Okay, first of all, looking back on your experience in Vietnam, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam and, I guess, your own involvement in Vietnam?
Well, at the time, I just went where I was told to go, so it didn't matter where it was. And when I got there, I guess what bothered me was seeing that we were doing all the fighting and that the Vietnamese wasn't, and that they always seemed to know what we were doing, and they didn't seem like they were ever doing anything. So, you know, I would say that I went where I was told to go, you know, as a Marine, and it could have been Korea or anywhere. But, you know, once I was there, it was mainly about our men, you know, about just keeping each other alive and getting home. And we didn't really know so much about what was going into politics while we were there. And we had very little information from home unless somebody got a paper or every now and then with a Stars and Stripes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your Stars and Stripes was kind of, I think, not telling the story like it was supposed to. But we really didn't know a lot about exactly what was going on in the political world. We just knew we had a battle, and we were fighting the battle, and it didn't seem like we were fighting it the way we should. But
right.
We didn't have any pull on what we could do.
All right. All right. You mentioned the Stars and Stripes in the way they were covering it. But how did you feel about, in general, about the way the media covered the war?
I didn't really read that much about what they said. Everything that I did read was more kind of lopsided in the way that the men that were fighting the war just seemed like they were either a guinea pig or just put out for slaughter. And you know, I just quit reading, and I would have papers come to me from the Commercial Appeal or Press Senator, whichever one it was at the time in Memphis, but, you know, very few of those ever got through, and when they did, you know, I would read a little bit about the war, and you know, it almost wanted to make you sick, some of the things that you would hear. You know, it was usually more about atrocities or crimes or, you know, something going on, always a death count. And
right.
So I just didn't care about it.
Sure.
I still don't. I still don't. I don't even have a TV, and I haven't watched TV in 5 years.
Mm.
Don't count, you know, ever watching TV again.
Right. All right. Well, what did you think of, I guess, of the anti-war movement and the protesters?
Well, I didn't like it, but, mm-hmm. you know, they had their rights to do what they wanted to. And, I just, you know, I didn't appreciate, you know, how they treated us. I mean, if they had their rights and they just talked about it and act on it without, you know, trying to spit on us and make us look like baby killers is one thing.
Sure.
But for those groups that wanted to put us down, you know, I just wanted to take them and put them in uniform for, you know, 24 hours and see how they would like it.
Right.
You know, and let them see some of the things we saw with the civilians and kids getting killed and things and, mm-hmm. you know, see who the real baby killers are.
Right.
It's like today, if somebody said something about being a baby killer, there's a great form out that shows a number of men and women killed in each war, and then it comes down to the number of babies have been killed by abortion,
mm-hmm.
and there are about 150 times all those that were killed in the war. So,
right.
you know, you could show them, I could show them something today if I was talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, back then I just took it for grain of salt and tried to go around them because I knew I'd get aggravated if I confronted them. So.
Right. Sure. Sure. All right. What do you think about U.S. policy, I guess, of reconciliation towards Vietnam today and this growing relationship with trade and all the other things going on with Vietnam today?
Well, I kind of look at it the same thing as happened with Japan and Germany and Italy.
Right.
You know, we have to move on and we have to grow. We have to do what God tells us, and let's love each other. And you know, it took me a long time to get to that point. Matter of fact, Wednesday night at church, I was listening to a young Vietnamese man give a class, and I just kind of, you know, had questions in my head. I wonder where his parents were and what they were doing in 68. And, you know, but I just let it be, you know, and I said, you know, I'm just thankful I'm here, and I guess I'm thankful he's here. So.
Right.
You know, I don't worry about that anymore.
Sure.
I've got a lot of guys that are still real bitter about it, but, you know, I just, you know, used to, if I saw them in the old days, I'd go, like I was shooting them or something and just walk on by them. But,
uh-huh.
you know, now it's just like, have a blessed day, you
right.
know. So they're God's children.
Uh-huh. Right.
They were doing what they were told to do, and a lot of them were being forced to do things, you know.
Sure.
So, you know. It's just one of those things you wish never had happened, but it did, and it's time to move on.
Right. All right. And one other thing I wanted to ask you along these lines.
Mm-hmm.
You've, and if you don't mind me asking this,
Sure.
you've mentioned your religion a few times here. Do you think that has helped you in some ways as far as making peace with Vietnam? Again, I don't want to put words into your mouth.
No, it has. When I was in Vietnam, I'd come to know the Lord about a year before I went.
Okay.
And I stood up a couple Sunday nights ago in front of our church and was giving my testimony. And one of the things I said, you know, the most peace I can remember having until recently was when I was in Vietnam in the middle of all the wars and battles that were going on. I had a peace about me that I was concerned about my men, but I wasn't concerned about me because I knew where I would be if anything happened. And that's the way I felt. And I was made the Protestant lay leader of our company. And I had service out in the field a couple times with our men. And I had a calm. And I guess that's why a lot of people were around me when things would happen. But they knew, you know, hey, Sergeant Story's here, you know, hang around him. So, I got along good with them, and they got along good with me. And, you know, now today, when I got back home, I kind of lost it a little bit after a while. It's like, why am I alive and not hurt? And I started having the guilt trip and did some stupid things. But then I started saying, you know, I need to get back to where I was. And I did. I got back to where I needed to be. And now no matter what battle comes up in my life, it's like Vietnam. I have a peace, and I just deal with it.
Right.
And so I feel good about myself now. And I still am the chaplain of our company reunions and get to say the prayer and the grace. And so,
all right.
So most of the guys that I know that are on the religious side, I think that's what's helped all of us get through it.
Mm. All right. you talked about the reunions. Could you talk a little bit more about those, I guess, and the significance of that first reunion that you attended?
Yeah, the first reunion was in Jacksonville, Florida, and it was, let's see, we've had six reunions now, so that's 12, about a little over 12 years ago.
Okay.
And what happened there is I was talking to a guy that had a website for the 7th Marines, and he was telling me that Echo Company was one of the few companies that never had a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, well, there's probably not many guys left. But anyway, I started getting where I could get around and internet. So I found a couple people, and I said, I wonder if these are my guys. And so I called them, and sure enough, they were. And we started talking, and we started saying, well, why don't we get together? And one of the guys I called lived in Jacksonville, and he had stayed in the Marines and retired. And he said, well, I've been trying to get guys together also. He said, why don't we do it together? And he asked if he could have the first one there in Jacksonville. We'd have the second one in Memphis. And I said, that's fine with me. So we found 25 guys from the company that between 1965 and 1970. So we all met down in Jacksonville, and we had a great time that weekend. I recognized each other. You could still see the facial expressions on most of us, and some guys brought some pictures, and we just had a nice, good time, and we had a color guard, and read the names of the guys at the time we knew who had died, and then we came to Memphis and invited some folks that we had found that lost their loved ones. And some of those folks that came, and their mother, and a couple of daughters, and a brother, and one of the guy's kids. And so we started helping them understand what had happened.
Right.
And it really helped them close the doors. They felt a lot better after we talked to them about how their loved one was killed. And we've got now about, I guess, 65, 70 guys that we found from 65, like I said, through 70 that were in the company. We just opened it up for everybody that was in Echo Company.
Mm-hmm.
And the most guys that we have, there's about 20 of us from 68. So we have a good time, and we enjoy it. We talk, a lot of us talk on the phone, or we send email to each other, and there's about a third of us do that. And, there's a couple guys that still don't want to go to any reunions. They're still all messed up about all this stuff. But anyway, it's been a good growing process for a lot of guys, for his healing also. So I've seen a big change in a lot of these guys. So I think it's something that's can be very helpful if it's done in the right way.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. All right. Let's see. Just a couple of more questions. One of them is, how would you say, how has Vietnam impacted your life the most? How would you say?
I think probably the attitude I had for so long that I couldn't die. I wouldn't wear seatbelts. I'd just get up and go. And, you know, you feel like, hey, I made it from Vietnam. I can make it through anything now. So,
uh-huh.
But I finally understood that that wasn't the case here in the last few years, and I'm getting a lot older. But I think the mental approach, you still have the nightmares. You still have some sweats. You still see ambushes everywhere you go. If you're out walking around in the woods and something grabs your foot, you have a thought process, and all of a sudden you just hit a booby trap. And, you know, those feelings and thoughts are still there, and I don't think they'll ever go away. And, you know, lots of people call it PTSD, you call it whatever you want to, but I think that's the worst thing. I think mentally, all the men were hurt just as much mentally as any physical wounds they ever had. And I think relationships, it's hurt me in having relationships with folks through the years until recently, but because you could walk away from anything and you didn't take anything. You just, a lot of times you just got to the point when you got back home that you didn't have to take that crap anymore, so you just walk away from things instead of confronting them again. So I think those are the biggest things.
All right. Okay.
And now, also, I think one of the big things is that when the guys in Iraq and Afghanistan, we support them.
Right.
We're there to help them, be with them, and let them learn, you know, from what our experiences were. So we're a whole lot more supportive now as a country than back in Vietnam.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, let's, have you ever visited the wall? And if so, what did you think of it?
I visited the wall three times. We had a reunion up in Virginia, Fredericksburg, and all of us went up to the wall and blew taps and put flags out of all our 88 guys that were lost. And it's amazing. For us that was there, there's no way that we can really go there without the tears and the emotions coming out. And,
sure.
But we know it's a place for them, and I know now we're working for a monument for the guys at Echo Company that it's going to be placed at the new museum in Quantico.
Oh, wow.
Marine
okay.
Corps Museum. So we're hoping that we'll have a monument there in the next few years that we're taking up money for that will have the names of all these guys on it also, as a lot of the other companies are doing there at Quantico. And that's a beautiful site, too, if you've never been to it.
No, sir, I haven't been there.
But. Yeah, it's a worthwhile stop, that's for sure.
All right. Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say, anything else we should cover before wrapping this up?
Not that I know of. I mean, as a young man, you know, went to a place the Marine Corps sent me, I ended up at a kind of a young rank, ended up being in charge of a lot of things. When I got back many years later, I saw all the unit awards that was given, and my company had won two presidential unit citations,
huh.
And which are equal to Navy crosses.
Wow.
We had won one Navy Commendation Medal, which is like a Silver Star for every man. And we won two meritorious units, which are like Bronze Stars for every man.
Oh,
so
wow.
Out of 13 operations, five of them were recognized by the unit. So, you know, I'm proud of our outfit. I'm proud of what we did.
Sure.
And how we took care of each other. And it was a war I wish they would have kept the politicians out and let the military minds fought. And that's part of living in this country, and I was glad I made it home, so I could see that the Lord's using me in a lot of ways now, and I always wondered why in the world I'd come home, and what in the world was the reason for it. Now I see a lot of reasons for it, but
right.
Anyway, I'm just glad to be here and have the opportunity to talk to you.
Yes, sir. Well, Well, thank you for taking the time to do this. I've certainly enjoyed talking with you last couple of days. But let me go ahead and...